It's business time, baby.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
My client,
Mama Monster,
conquered the street.
You like fighting a woman?
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Come over here and fight me.
Delete. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
This is episode 558 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off, here for Sunday, August 5th, 2018. I am the Sala Monster. I'm sure some of you saw me live tweeting that abomination on Tuesday night. And I don't mean SmackDown. I'm talking about the Mets. They lost 25-4 on Tuesday to the Washington Nationals because they are an embarrassment of a team. The worst loss in the 57-year history of this franchise. They brought in Jose Reyes, an infielder, in the eighth inning to pitch for the first time in his career. That's how desperate things got. His earned run average now stands at a cool 54, which was also the number of times I banged my head against the wall during this game. You know, the last time Jose Reyes pitched, I didn't realize this. I didn't know this until I read in the Times. Last time Jose Reyes pitched was not in the majors. It was in the Dominican Republic when he was 11 years old. We would have had a better chance with a team of 11-year-olds out there. The only thing missing was Tyler Bate throwing in the white towel. And somebody asked me, you know, which is worse, Raw or the Mets? Which is an unfair comparison because, as I told this person, I said the Mets have an offseason. So there's your answer. But there is a company, and I had so many people send me messages about this, and I was already aware of it. But there is a company, this is legit, that is offering, now obviously it's a gimmick, but it is a legitimate offer. Offering free therapy sessions to Mets fans after this debacle of a loss, and really for this whole debacle of a season. The website is freetherapyformetsfans.com. And it will redirect you to the website for this healthcare provider. You can redeem your free therapy session if you use that URL. And I heard about this, and I just thought to myself, you know your team is terrible when a healthcare provider offers free therapy to its fans. Such is the plight of the New York Mets here in 2018. Let's shift to something happy, a happier subject. Two announcements to make here I'm very excited about. First, in case you didn't see the invite online, we are doing another meetup SummerSlam weekend, for those of you who have asked. This will be our third year in a row at the King's Beer Hall, the KBH, in Brooklyn, 84 St. Mark's Place. It's just a few blocks away from the Barclays Center. Saturday, August 18th, starting at 2 p.m. That leads right into the NXT TakeOver show that night. So that is the day before SummerSlam. I don't want there to be any confusion about it being the day of SummerSlam. It is the day before SummerSlam. There will be a wrestling-themed menu. I should have that to share with you guys online tomorrow as far as drink specials go. All ages are welcome until 5 p.m. that day. I edited the invite to make this little addendum, which was not in the original invite. But all ages are welcome until 5 o'clock. Normally the cutoff is 3 p.m. on Saturdays, but they are extending that to 5 o'clock. So come earlier, I guess, if you fall into that category, or if you're going to the NXT show maybe and you're bringing your kids with you, just make sure to get there earlier rather than later. There is no cover charge to get in. It is always free to be part of this. Our good friend Julian Cannon, big fan of the podcast, he will be in attendance once again. He's going to be raffling off some great prizes, including a copy of the new WWE 2K19 game for the console of your choice. If you are the first place winner, there'll be a second place winner who gets their choice of t-shirt. Third place winner, that's usually the way the raffle works. It is free to enter. All you have to do is show up. You show up, you get a ticket, and then we'll be doing a random drawing later in the afternoon. So I'm looking forward to seeing everybody there. I just finished my physical therapy on my knee for now because I have scheduled my knee surgery for the end of this month. I am going to go ahead and get this taken care of. There's glass in my knee, and I don't like there being glass in my knee, so I'm going to have it taken out. But I put it off until the end of the month, largely so I can get through this whole weekend without any issues. I want to be able to see everybody and have a good time before they open me back up. So Please, if you have not done so already, and we already have about 30 people already who have RSVP'd in the affirmative, we have over 40 people who have put down that they are interested in attending. Please RSVP to the Facebook invite so that I can get some sense of a headcount. I'll link to it on my Twitter, and you can find it on the fan page for the Sound Off on Facebook. The other announcement is that the night before our meetup, so that Friday before SummerSlam, August 17th, House of Glory Wrestling is holding its biggest event of the year. It's this event called High Intensity 7, featuring Impact World Champion Austin Aries, Sami Callihan, Low-Ki, LAX. There'll be an appearance by Real One, the former Enzo Amore. He'll be in attendance doing who knows what. This is in Queens, New York. House of Glory is one of the bigger independent promotions in the Northeast. It's run by Amazing Red. I will be there that night. I'm very excited to be part of the show in some small way. I'll be joining JD from New York for a special pre-show panel that we're doing, talking to some of the names I just mentioned. That'll be right before the show. If you are attending the show, please stop by and say hello. If you're not attending the show, you should. Tickets are still available. It's going to be a fun night. JD does the announcing for House of Glory shows. I know, you know, he's a fan of the podcast, and when the opportunity came up for us, you know, to do something together and to do something for House of Glory, it was just too good to pass up. So I'm excited. I actually dropped by their training school after work on Tuesday this week, and Amazing Red was in there training with all, you know, each one of his students. He was getting in there with them, and I would say he's a pretty good person to learn from. So that was fascinating to watch. But anyway, so very excited to be able to announce that. I'll talk more about that next week, because I think we have one more podcast before all that goes down. Audible, you guys know the drill. Keep using the link. It's still active and still available for you if you want to cash in and get one free audiobook on the Sound Off. Audibletrial.com/Solomonster. Every time you use that link, and I don't mean just punch it in. I mean go to the link. Sign up for the free trial. You can sample it out for 30 days. When you do that, the podcast gets a little kickback in return, and it helps the show, and you get one free audiobook of your choosing that you get to keep even if you cancel your trial before the month is up. So audibletrial.com/Solomonster. Also, I don't mention it as often, but I should, because you guys can get 20% off your first crate, pro wrestling crate. If you put the code Solomonster in there, you can get 20% off your first crate, so definitely check that out. And last but not least here, I want to shout out each one of our PayPal supporters for this week. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout out. I want to say thank you to John Loose Cannon Lopez. This is our team here. I wish we can get all the PayPal VIPs here together for this for like a special meetup somewhere. I don't know where. I think it would be very hard to have one central location where we can get everybody together. But if you're going to be in Brooklyn, hopefully I'll see you on the 18th. But thank you to John Luis Cannon Lopez, the Florida Freebird, Brian Becerra, Out of Control, Cody Thomas, Beast Mode, Brock Joseph, Raymond the Mountie Medina, Malicious Intent, Michael Cuomo, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, The Show Off, Corey Van Dam, The Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, The Brooklyn Bombers, Jamel and Isaiah Walker, and a happy 42nd birthday to Jamel. I'm looking forward to seeing him in Brooklyn in a few weeks. And if not then, hopefully then, but if not then, definitely next year for WrestleMania. Aaron Lights Out Lewis, shout out to his two boys, Will and Jack, and to his partner Hannah, who is expecting twin girls in December. So congratulations to them. See, now that's consistency. Two boys, two girls. That's probably, I mean, that would be more than enough for me, but I don't know. I don't know what their plans are, but may they be born healthy and take advantage of all of the opportunities afforded to them by the great Stephanie McMahon. The Malaysian mastermind, Samuel T., thank you. Aim for the Head, Andrew Jorlog. Luis Hercules Hernandez. Bobby the Wizard Waldrop. The Ambassador of Disaster, Chase Wood. The Renton Road Warrior, Taylor Schatt. Flyboy, Jasvani Rollins. The Anarchist, Andrew Heller. The Orlando Commando, Christopher Thompson. The Sin City Superstar, Peter Sanders. James Grandmaster Galley. Mario from the Barrio Medina, who is celebrating a birthday tomorrow. Happy birthday to him. And that's it. So thank you to everybody who made a donation. If you didn't see it, unfortunately, last Sunday was a sad day in wrestling. There were four different wrestling personalities who passed away. last weekend, really, I think all in the same day. I did not do a podcast on Sunday. I did the podcast a few days earlier because I was away for a wedding. So what I did was I recorded a Sound Off Extra last Sunday, about 25 minutes long, just to talk about all the people who died, which is a horrible reason to do a Sound Off Extra. And hopefully I never have to do one of those again. But just to follow up on that, there is no real update on the death of Brian Christopher. I did talk a lot about him on that video I did up on the YouTube channel. He had been incarcerated since the beginning of July after a third DUI arrest. He was found hanging in his jail cell. And then he was put on life support. They kept him alive long enough for Jerry Lawler to rush back. He was at one of these Comic-Con type events somewhere. Kept him on life support long enough so that, you know, his father could show up and say his final goodbyes. And then he was taken off. The only comment that Jerry Lawler had made before the ceremony they had for him on Friday, he made some comment to the effect of there being more than meets the eye to what happened here, which sort of, you hear something like that and it makes you think that he knows something we don't, that there may be foul play involved and maybe it wasn't a suicide. But according to the cops, there is no foul play suspected. However, they are doing an investigation, so I suspect we'll find out in due time. I saw some friends of Brian's pitched in to buy him a special casket with the Pittsburgh Steelers logo on it because he was a huge Steelers fan. It had the letters GMS emblazoned on it, and then in little lettering, you know, under each letter, it said Grandmaster Sexay. They had a ceremony for him on Friday. A local news station spoke to Jerry Lawler, who said that it was the worst day of his entire life, and he could barely stay composed as they were talking to him. The saddest thing about all of, I mean, besides what actually happened here, but the saddest thing about all of this was from the Observer story that Meltzer wrote up in the newsletter this week, where he mentioned that Brian was being held on $40,000 bond. So he could have easily been released weeks ago. Now, his father had bailed him out of certain situations like this before and tried to get him help. And so he could have been bailed out weeks ago, but, you know, Jerry Lawler decided, he talked to some of his own friends and people who knew Brian, and he had made the decision not to pay the money and let him stay in jail for a while because that, in his mind, would actually be better for him. It would be safer for him to be in that environment as opposed to being released and back out on his own. And the plan was that when he was ready to, I don't know if he was going to bail him out or if they were just going to wait until Brian was released, but the plan was that when Brian was ultimately released, he would take him straight to rehab to get him the help that he needed. And that really, it doesn't sound like an unreasonable plan, but, you know, if you're Jerry Lawler, I can't imagine what he must be thinking in his head right now, hindsight being 20/20. You know, what if I just would have bailed him out? Right? But, you know, you think about that. You can't think that way. He made the decision that he felt was in his son's best interest. His son clearly had issues. He clearly had demons of his own that he was battling. He thought he was doing the right thing. He had no inkling that something like this might happen. And then something like this does happen, and it's just got to eat you up inside. So I really, you know, for that reason, I feel badly for him. And, you know, I just saw my doctor, my oncologist on Friday. He was actually my mother's doctor for many, many, many years, and her doctor is now my doctor. Talk about circle of life. And he just told me the other day that one of the nurses who helped my mother when she was in the hospital back in February, so this was maybe the second to last time that she was in and out of the hospital before things really started going downhill. But this nurse, young girl, really nice. He told me the other day that she committed suicide. No warning signs or anything. And I was blown away when he told me that. You just sit there and you ask yourself, why? Why would somebody so young take their own life? You know, here's somebody who dedicated their life to helping others, and she was apparently dealing with some kind of pain herself that nobody knew about. It's just very sad when things like this happen and there's no rhyme or reason for it. WWE Hall of Famer Nikolai Volkoff also passed away last Sunday, 70 years old, according to Brian Blair, president of the Cauliflower Alley Club. And it is not, The irony of that is not lost on me if you know the history and the things that Iron Sheik has said about Brian Blair. And it's Brian Blair, of all people, who sort of broke this news. But he shared the news that Volkov had a heart attack recently. He was told that he needed open heart surgery. He declined. Then he was told he needed a stent put in his heart, which helps keep the arteries open and unclogged. And he turned that down as well. So perhaps not all that surprising that something like this would happen. But he passed away last Sunday as well. And again, I talked about this in the video I did. Tracy Caddell, the father of Trevor Lee, who helped co-found the Omega Wrestling promotion with Matt Hardy in the early 90s, he also passed away last Sunday. That was the day after his 50th birthday. Trevor Lee posted a tweet with a link to a GoFundMe page somebody had set up to help pay for his father's funeral expenses. He said the funeral home needs the money before they could bury him. And they set a $9,000 goal. And yes, I can attest, funeral expenses are absolutely out of control in this country. So are medical costs. This whole country is out of control right now. But $9,000 was the goal. And at last check, they had raised over $10,000, actually closer to $11,000. And so that was the update on Tracy Caddell. Nikolai Volkov, Brickhouse Brown, Caddell, and Brian Christopher, all in the same 24-hour period, basically, made for a pretty horrible weekend last week. And I know Volkov and Christopher did get video graphics at the beginning of all the shows this week. Let us hope that we can make it through the remainder of this year without having to memorialize another wrestler, because four in one day is four too many. To the surprise of no one, Glenn Jacobs, running as a Republican, beat Democrat Linda Haney 66% to 34% to become the next mayor of Knox County, Tennessee. Mayor Kane begins his term on September 1st. We all know Kane is a nice guy, so everybody says about him, everybody who's worked with him. He's obviously a very bright person, very articulate, very intelligent. Policy-wise, how he does remains to be seen. That's a different story. He said before that his winning does not necessarily mean he is done with wrestling, so any talk about him being retired and how come people aren't talking more about the fact that now Kane is retired, if anything, he's temporarily retired. I don't for one second believe that Kane has wrestled his last match. He does not either. He has been very clear in that. I have not one time heard him come out and say that if I win this race, my wrestling career is over. I'm going to hang up my boots. That's it. Because look, even if he didn't wrestle while he was mayor, and I think he will at some point, but even if he didn't, eventually he won't be mayor anymore and he'll be back to wrestling. So if you are a Canaanite, if you are a big fan of his, I would not worry about that. I don't think we've seen the last of him. He does have an Achilles injury, though. He still has a walking boot on one of his feet. Somebody at his victory party, I guess one of the reporters, noticed he had some sort of boot on his foot and didn't know why, and they asked him about it. And they say, hey, is this injury wrestling-related? And he claimed it was tendonitis from walking around to knock on so many doors. So he's already got the lying thing down like any good politician, or wrestler for that matter. This dude's a worker. There was a WWE camera crew following him around all day, the day of the election, including when the results came in. So perhaps we'll get a WWE 24 special out of it on the network, which might be kind of cool. You know, about his journey from pro wrestler to politician. Other wrestlers kind of blend the two together, like Hulk Hogan or Triple H. Kane, at least, is keeping the two separate. So congratulations to him. It's a cool thing when something like that happens, if for no other reason, because I think even all these years after Jesse Ventura became the governor of Minnesota, which is a much bigger deal than becoming the mayor of Knox County, I still think you have a good segment of the population that really doesn't give these guys credit for being anything but, you know, kind of mouth-breathing, knuckle-dragging Neanderthals with one tooth who wrestle in a barn somewhere. I mean, there is still a stereotype of wrestlers like that. And every time I hear about a wrestler who does well or is elected to office or even somebody like The Rock, right? And that's a different case altogether. I mean, the kind of success that he's had. But whether you like the person or not, I think if you're a fan, it kind of has to put a little bit of a smile on your face because I think each time that happens, it shuts those people up and just sort of shows them a different side of these guys that they otherwise would not be aware of. And this is probably a good place to bring this up. In honor of Kane's big election win, I got an email asking, well, two emails actually. One was asking me my thoughts on Kane's legacy in WWE. So if his career were to end now, let's say, what is his legacy in WWE as compared to some of the other big names? And I'll say this right now. I think Kane's legacy is right up there with The Undertaker. I know Undertaker has been in the company a little bit longer than he has. Although if you include his early runs as Isaac Yankem and Fake Diesel and whatnot, he really, Undertaker doesn't have that many more years on Kane. You know, Undertaker came in 1990, and if you go back to Isaac Yankem, that was 95, Kane was 97. So yeah, Undertaker's been around longer, but honestly, I think if you add up and you look at all the injuries and all the time off that Undertaker has had over the years, even before he went to the whole once a year or twice a year wrestling schedule, Kane has been full-time on this roster for so long and has been injured so few times. The only time I can ever remember Kane having like a major injury, major surgery, was a torn bicep that he had in 2002. I don't recall ever hearing about Kane having any knee surgery, knee issues, which for a big guy like him working a full-time schedule, you know, the guy's almost 7 feet tall, 300 pounds. That's pretty impressive that, you know, we haven't heard about him having significant knee problems. That torn bicep is the only major injury I can think of that, and now I guess he's got the boot on his foot for the Achilles. But when you look at all of the time that Kane has put in that character, and, you know, the very little time off, I think, comparatively to The Undertaker that he's had, their careers virtually mirror each other, I think, in terms of time served. And, you know, The Undertaker has gone through a lot of transformations of his own over the years. He's gone from heel to babyface to heel to babyface. We had the Grey Glove Undertaker. We had Ministry Undertaker, Teardrop Undertaker. We had, you know, the American Badass and Big Evil, Back to the Dead Man. And so he's reinvented himself a whole bunch of times, and his legacy speaks for itself. But then I look at Kane, and here's a guy who can play the big monster. He can play a comedy character or somebody who at least incorporates comedy into their character, which is something Undertaker has never done, aside from those few funny skits during the whole Alliance thing during the invasion. There was some back and forth with him and Stone Cold that was hilarious, but Undertaker has never really, I don't think anybody would ever mistake him for being a comedy character at any point during his career. Kane is a versatile guy. He can play any role you put him in. You need him to be a heel, he'll be a heel. You need him to be a babyface, he'll be a babyface. You want him to be funny, he can be funny. You want him to just rip people to shreds, he can do that too. And, you know, he's won so many tag team titles and intercontinental titles, and he's been a world champion and a hardcore champion, and it's just, you look at the body of work that he has put in and the constant returns and being, you know, vaulted back into the main event, even times when frankly he should not have been in the main event. And, you know, he was part of the whole authority angle and right up until present day and the recent return with Daniel Bryan and Team Hell No. You know, his legacy, he's going to go down as one of the best big men of all time. And in terms of time served in this company, I would put his legacy right up there with The Undertaker. Undertaker may have been a bigger deal in terms of the WrestleMania streak and all of that. But when it comes to, you know, sort of MVP status and you need to put somebody in there, if other people go down with injuries or you need somebody to wrestle, you know, in these live events or something, I mean, he's been putting a lot more work in recent years than Undertaker has. And he's a very versatile performer, and I think that, to me, is his legacy. He can play any position, like a position player. He can do anything you need him to do. And somehow, some way, for all the talk about every time there's a Kane return, oh my God, it's Kane, he's 50 years old, enough with Kane. I will say this, every time this guy makes a comeback, the place goes nuts, at least on night one. He'll make some big return and big comeback and get the pyro treatment, and everybody goes nuts, and it's like, you kind of roll back the hands of time. So he's got that, you know, that character, I think, is one of those beloved characters that will go down as one of the best that, you know, Vince McMahon has ever come up with. So that, to me, is his legacy. Now, the other question I got from somebody else was wanting to know my favorite version. What is my favorite version, my favorite incarnation of the Kane character? Because he's gone through many phases, right? He's gone through many outfits over the years. And like I said before, he can be this, he can be that. Which version is my favorite? I will always be partial to the original 1997 Kane, okay? And the original mask and the original costume and Paul Bearer doing the talking for him. That guy was a monster. He was out there setting people on fire for crying out loud. But my favorite period of Kane was early 2000 Kane. And when he made that return, one of his many, many returns, but he made a comeback. He was only gone, I think, off TV for a few weeks, which is kind of funny. He wasn't really gone that long. But this was after the Royal Rumble in 2000 and maybe a couple of weeks later. It was on Raw. I've talked about this match many times before. I mentioned it even in the video I think I did when I was talking about Brian Christopher, because he was part of it, that big 10-man tag on Raw in Dallas back in February of 2000. It was Too Cool and Rikishi and Cactus Jack and The Rock against Triple H and the Radicals. And I defy you, I dare you, to find me very many Raw matches or Raw main events in the 20-some-odd year history of that TV show where you have a crowd as electric as the crowd was in Dallas that night. It was just the perfect storm of circumstances and talent that was over at the time. And the crowd was just, it was incredible. And the amount of talent that was packed into that match, it was just, it was a hot main event. And at the very end of that match, when it was over and the heels are beating down the baby faces, the lights go out, out comes Paul Bearer, very trim-looking Paul Bearer, wearing that red coat, and the pyro goes off, and out comes Kane, which to me, that is still his greatest return, the greatest comeback that he's ever made for all the times he's come back. That's the one. That is the best one. And he's walking down to the ring. He still has, it's sort of a more updated version of the original outfit. You know, it was more black than red, whereas, you know, when he first debuted, he was more red than black. But there's this iconic shot when he gets down to the ring where he kind of reaches up and pulls himself up, you know, by the top rope, and he's just standing on the apron with his back turned to the camera. And in the ring, all the heels are all huddled together, Triple H and Dean Malenko and Chris Benoit and the New Age Outlaws and Perry Saturn and X-Pac, and they're all huddling together trying to figure out what the hell they're going to do here. And all we see is Kane from behind. And this guy is standing there. He looks like, I mean, this guy is built like a brick shithouse. He looked like he was etched out of granite standing there. And he just, you know, he's doling out one-arm choke slams like they were going out of style. And then even the next episode on SmackDown, I think, is the one where he gave Tori the tombstone. That's where the whole tombstone Tori thing comes from. And the place was going nuts. And it's funny, I think back to that, and I watched those clips recently. You know, they call Brock Lesnar the Beast, right? That's his nickname, that's the tagline they use for him. He's the Beast. No, 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 no. Kane. Kane from 2000, that's a real fucking beast right there. Go back and watch at least those first few weeks after he came back. That is a beast. And, you know, even 2003. Reinvented himself again. Now, I wasn't a fan at the time when they took the mask off. I thought that was a mistake. Although there is something to be said for things get stale, you gotta try something new. But they took the mask off of him, and all of a sudden, he became a monster again. Because he would literally be led to the ring in chains. He had the black towel over his head. Gave Linda McMahon a tombstone on the stage. You know, we all know what he did to poor Shane McMahon. So there again is an example of Kane being reinvented in a different way. No mask, but once again, he was relevant and built up to be this unstoppable force until ultimately he wasn't, and then he was impregnating Lita and that whole stuff in 2004, I guess it would have been, with Snitsky. Maybe a little, maybe it was later. Maybe it was 05. So anyway, that's my favorite version of Kane, was the one from early 2000 when he made that big comeback on Raw. To me, there was no, I mean, he was completely unstoppable. And I would put that version of Kane up against Brock Lesnar and Vader and anyone else who came through the doors in WWE as far as monsters are concerned. That to me is my favorite version. But what about you? What say you? What is your favorite version of Kane? Everybody can chime in on this. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Big Cass. Haven't heard his name in a little while here. He has his first independent booking since being released by WWE on June 19th, and typically there's a 90-day non-compete if you are released from your contract, which would be September 19th, is when it would run out, and so it was announced that he will make his big-time wrestling debut in Spartanburg, South Carolina, on September 21st, on a show that will also feature Mick Foley, Hacksaw Jim Duggan, Meng, and the Barbarian, yes, the Faces of Fear, Tommy Dreamer, James Ellsworth, gonna have all these names on that show, see, so beat that all in. And that's not even the best part of this story. The best part is that Big Cass is no longer Big Cass. Oh no. He has a new name now. Because Big Cass belongs to WWE. Well, what do? You got to come up with a new name. And that new name is Big Kaz. With two Z's. 1999 called. They want their name back. Remember back then it was all cool to add Z's to the end of your name? Even Taz. Taz added a Z to his name when he came to WWE. And all, you know, the rumors about, well, you know, it was something with the Taz Manian Devil cartoon character. It was a rights issue. Nah, don't buy that. Taz wanted to be cool, so he tacked on the Z to his name. Because what's better than one Z? Why? Two Z's, of course. Reminds me, actually, when I was in Colombia, I heard a lot about this 2Z stuff. Didn't quite know what it was. I was smartened up real quick to what that meant. But anyway, the Hardy Boys, remember the Hardy Boys back then? They became the Hardy Boys. The Dudleys became the Dudley Boys. It's the closest thing to his old name, so I mean, I guess it's, you know, it's his brand or something, and he wanted to keep it as close to the old name as possible. I think the name is shit, but to each their own. It just makes me think he has to get back together with Enzo now, right? Enzo, Big Kaz, can call themselves Z Gangsters. Maybe get Zeus to manage them. I don't know. And Ellsworth is on that show too, on that big-time wrestling show. Now there's a storyline waiting to happen if they wanted to go in that direction. There's a whole story they could tell there with those two. The G1 Climax continues. Unfortunately, it's winding down very soon, which makes me sad. But I got to check out a whole bunch of more G1 matches since the last podcast I did. I watched four matches from night 10 of the G1, which was back on July 28th. And let me just say this. The G1, I mean, you probably don't need me to tell you this, but the G1 is the best thing going right now in all of wrestling. It usually is, but it's just awesome. There's something for everybody, right? You want action? You got plenty of action. You want comedy? There's some of that too. You want good stories? Plenty of those. Good promos? Juice Robinson has been cranking out some of the best. He had a match with Toriano that was mostly comedy here on night 10. I thought it was the weakest of those matches that I watched. Yano's promise not to break the rules has been broken so many times now. He went after Juice's broken hand, which he sold. But he hit Pulp Friction, picked up his first win of the tournament for Juice Robinson. Juice has been very frustrated that he could not win a single match, but he finally exercised that demon. He finally was able to get his 2 points. Then I know after that he beat Sonata. So at last check, I believe Juice has 4 points in the G1, so he won't be winning, but at least he's on the board. Kota Ibushi and Tomohiro Ishii, my new favorite match of the tournament, at least until the Ishii-Omega match that I'll talk about here in a second. It hurt me to watch Ishii throw some of those chops and some of those palm strikes that he hit Ibushi with. Whenever Ishii does those chops to the throat, it scares the shit out of me. I mean, he does not hold back. And these guys killed each other. They brawled deep into the crowd. Ibushi climbed one level up, like on the balcony area, hit a moonsault onto Ishii. Ishii hit Ibushi with his own Kamigoye knee strike. Ibushi sold. I love the way Ibushi sells these moves. Like, he's concussed 5 times over. Actually, he probably was concussed 5 times over in this match. Then Ishii hit a last ride powerbomb for a near fall. Another one of Ibushi's moves. Ishii went for a brainbuster, but Ibushi reversed it into one of his own. Ishii no-sold it. He no-sold his own finish. Ibushi was able to hit the Kamigoye for the win. Just an absolutely insane match. I mean, if any of you have not been watching but want recommendations, absolutely go out of your way to watch that match. And there's a few more you can add to your list here. We have Kenny Omega against Sonata. And I guess I haven't really mentioned Sonata a whole lot because I haven't seen all of his matches in the G1. I've seen some of them. But he's another one who's, I think, had a pretty damn good G1. And, I mean, look, I remember Sonata when TNA brought him in, right? When he came to Impact, he was a champion there for a little while. He was kind of this clean-cut babyface. And, you know, it's interesting. Impact in its history has a history of some of these current New Japan stars kind of getting their start in the U.S. there in Impact, and they didn't either do much with them, or actually, you know, Sonata had some success. They didn't really blow him up as a big deal. But Sonata now is a very different performer than he was then. But that happened to come at a time when I was watching Impact, and I remember him from them, and to see him then compared to him now, he has evolved greatly and gotten a lot better, and I think he's another name that deserves a lot of attention for the G1 that he's been having. And this match with Omega I thought was great. I thought this was an excellent match. They had a tough act to follow coming after Ibushi and Ishii, but this was a great match, and you know, Omega worked over Sonata's left leg. There were a few points where Omega sold his heel injury. He broke his heel doing a dive at the Cow Palace show a few weeks ago in that match with Cody, and that is a legitimate injury. Apparently, it's all padded and taped up, and it hasn't really affected his matches at all, so it can't be that serious. But like Juice Robinson with the hand, each of them have legitimate injuries that have been incorporated into the stories. They've been incorporated into these matches, and it hasn't slowed these guys down at all. Tons of V-triggers, J-Driller by Omega for a near fall. He went for the one-winged angel. Sonata turned it into Skull End, which is not a move I'd want to find myself in against the guy who's been sweating profusely for 20 minutes with his pit in your face. Although, I'd take Sonata over Brian Knobbs doing it to me any day of the week. Sonata eventually fell victim, though, to the one-winged angel. Anyway, that brought Kenny Omega up to this point in the tournament to 5-0. So then I watched a couple more matches yesterday, and these were two of the best of the G1. As insane as that match was with Ibushi and Ishii, Ishii's match with Kenny Omega was even more insane. Somehow. I don't know how, but it was. Ishii, to me, has to be the MVP of this tournament. And I know we have a few more dates left before it's over. I was thinking Ibushi, but after this match and just the quality of matches that this guy keeps cranking out, against so many different opponents in this tournament, I don't think it can be anybody else but Ishii as the MVP of this G1. And how he doesn't have a broken neck for all the abuse that he takes of that area. I mean, this guy's neck must be made of titanium. He'll have titanium in there soon enough if he's not careful. But Omega busted his mouth open somewhere in here. I didn't really see how. And by the end of the match, it looked either like his lip was dangling, or it may have just been a shitload of blood that was sort of, you know, kind of this ball of blood that was dripping off his lip. I don't know what it was, but his mouth looked to be in rough shape. And Ishii was bleeding from the mouth, and Omega must have hit 35 different V-triggers on this poor bastard. Nothing would keep this guy down. A J-driller, there you go, easy for me to say. That couldn't keep him down. Omega hit him with his own brainbuster move. Ishii kicked out. Not only did he kick out, he kicked out at one. So then Ishii hit a couple of stiff lariats and a brainbuster of his own to hand Kenny Omega the very first loss in this of his in this G1 climax. Omega is undefeated no longer. Just an incredible match that you have to go out of your way to find. As you should, the Kota Ibushi Tetsuya Naito match that followed it. Too many times, I will say this about that Ibushi Naito match, too many times, these guys dropped one another right on top of their heads. I don't mean on the back of their neck, they did that too. I mean right on top of their friggin' skull. And remember Hiromu? Hiromu was out with a broken neck for 9 months. Ibushi himself had a herniated disc in his neck a few years ago. He may have had surgery for it. These guys are too valuable to lose to a similar injury. So when I see shit like that, I cringe. You know, because it's just not necessary. These guys can beat the piss out of each other and they can drop each other, you know, with brainbusters and suplexes and do all that stuff. But there was stuff in this match I just watched and I'm like, they're asking for something to happen here. But still an incredible battle between these two guys. Ibushi even used Nakamura's Bomae for a near fall before finally hitting the Kamigoye for the win. So Kota Ibushi picks up the win heading into his match with Kenny Omega, which is coming up. Now, these are the standings as of this morning. They look like this. In the A block, Tanahashi has 14 points, Okada has 12, and Jay White has 12. And in the B block, Kenny Omega has 12, Ibushi has 10, and Naito has 10. And look at this. Look at what we have left here in this tournament. The final A block match on Friday is Tanahashi against Okada. And the final B block match on Saturday is Kenny Omega against Kota Ibushi. And then, of course, the winners of those two matches will meet one another in the finals on Sunday. So this is shaping up to be a hell of a finish here to this tournament. And here's my guess, and that's all this is, because really it's anyone. I think it's anyone's ballgame here. And that's one of the things I kind of like about this, is that the winner is not very predictable at all. I don't see how it's obvious that this person will win or this person will win. It's up in the air. It can still go three or four different ways here. But this is my guess. I'm thinking Omega and Ibushi go to a draw. But Kenny still makes it to the finals. I think that's possible. I hope so. So they draw. Omega ends up in the finals, though, and he wrestles Tanahashi. Just because Omega and Okada, I mean, it's been done to death recently. I think there has to be some daylight put between those two. Like, I could see them wanting to do that as a main event maybe at the ROH New Japan show at Madison Square Garden. You know, Omega, Okada, assuming Omega's still, you know, with them and doesn't sign with WWE. I could see that being a big enough match where to do that in the Garden, yes, I think that would be a good idea. But as opposed to doing Omega, Okada here in the finals, I think you do Omega Tanahashi. Omega beats Tanahashi to win the G1, and he ends up choosing Kota Ibushi. Instead of Ibushi winning and he has the briefcase and gets the Wrestle Kingdom shot and all that, Kenny wins and he chooses to defend the championship against Kota at Wrestle Kingdom. That's my prediction. Unless I have the rules all screwed up with the points and the draws and whatnot. I guess Naito can also still sneak into the finals. There's still a chance of that. But I'm going to go with a Kenny Omega win. Omega faces Yano, by the way, on Wednesday. So if Omega loses to friggin' Yano, then all bets are off. Monday Night Raw. Let's talk about this show here. Raw Monday Night was in Miami, Florida. Raw Twitter poll had almost 3,000 votes. 24% thumbs up, 76%. Percent thumbs down. Boy, were there a lot of salty people on Twitter Monday night during this show. I tweeted out something about Brock Lesnar reading a magazine and how forced the whole angle felt with him refusing to even come out to the ring. You know, even though he's never had a problem bouncing up and down behind Paul Heyman before. But anyway, so I post this and a handful of idiots take great offense to this. It bothered them greatly that they were enjoying the show and I wasn't, because God forbid somebody should have an opinion that differs from theirs. And I just look at this and I go, what do you work for the company? Like, are you their spokesman? What do you care what other people think about the show in terms of, you know, whether they enjoy it or they hate it? Everybody is going to have a different opinion of what they're watching. You know, there are people, look, who voted in this poll, 24% thumbs up, 76% thumbs down. There are people who may think, 76% thumbs up is what Raw should have gotten. And that's their opinion. They're entitled to their opinion. But it just seems to bother people so much. It's just comical to me. Like, why does it bother people this much that I did not like the Brock Lesnar stuff, by and large? I mean, there were some parts of it that I found a little amusing. But the whole storyline, I don't like it. Why does that bother people? How does that equate to me being always negative? See, this is how I can differentiate the trolls from the people who actually listen to this show. In a week where I had nothing but praise for the Randy Orton stuff on SmackDown the week before, and nothing but praise for their choice of Samoa Joe as an opponent for AJ Styles and that whole segment, among other things that I liked, that doesn't suit their narrative. So let's paint with a broad brush here and say that, well, he's negative about everything. I love it. I love it. I love it. Selective hearing is a bitch. I especially like this idea that I'm apparently not allowed to tweet my own opinions of the show out on my own page. Like, these people get so offended by this, it physically brings me joy. Like, I'm getting goosebumps right now just thinking about it. It warms my cockles to see them get their undies in a bunch, right? Didn't Vince McMahon once say that? It warms my cockles. I don't even know what cockles are. I don't know where they would be on the human body, where you would find them, but I can feel how warm they are right now. Do you know how many times in a given week, during Raw or during SmackDown, I reply tweet someone that I follow or even someone I don't follow to their opinion of the show that they're watching? So, like, if I see something in the timeline that they say about a show, I'll, like, rush to, you know, reply tweet to it. Oh, like, if someone says, oh, SmackDown sucks or the G1 sucks. Like, do you know how many times I've reply tweeted them to tell them that they're wrong? Or that they're in the minority on this. You know how many times I've done that? Zero. That's how many times. None. Because they're entitled to their opinion, however wrong I think they may be. I don't understand why it would bother somebody so much that they would feel compelled to do that. Like, you're not going to change my opinion. I don't know what they're ever looking to accomplish when they do stuff like this. So what exactly do you expect to gain from it? Other than being blocked or muted. My only regret is that I didn't mute some of these people. That's even better than blocking. That way they end up talking to themselves without even realizing it. It's like the greatest thing ever. So by all means, please, please continue hanging on to my every word. Like garbage in the gas tank of a DeLorean, okay? It's the fuel that keeps me going. So on this Raw stuff, there was a show-long storyline. And that show-long storyline was that Brock Lesnar finally showed up to work, but he refused to go out to the ring. So he flew all the way to Miami from Canada or wherever the hell he's living these days just to sit in the back and read magazines throughout the entire show. But he refused to actually go out to the ring because, you see, the story is that he's lazy and he doesn't care about the WWE universe and he doesn't care about anything. And you should all cheer for Roman Reigns or something to that effect. That's the basic story that they're trying to tell here. And they showed Lesnar sitting on a couch in the back reading a magazine called The Backwoodsman, which is in fact a real magazine. According to Wikipedia, it features a bunch of how-to guides and frequent subjects include making canoes. I would watch a show about Brock Lesnar trying to build a canoe myself. I think that should be on the network. Building canoes, homemade welders, black powder cannons, beer, and clothing. Those are some of the subjects covered in The Backwoodsman. I thought he was just reading one magazine throughout the entire show. There was a second magazine called American Frontiersman, and here I thought Brock, you know, typically sat at home reading Us Weekly and Good Housekeeping, so I guess I learned something on Monday. But after Roman Reigns called Brock a bitch at the beginning of the show, Paul Heyman went up to Brock. Heyman was doing his damnedest to try to get Brock to come out to the ring. He was begging him. He was imploring this man, please go out to the ring. My job is on the line here. And he asked him at first, he goes, Brock, did you hear what Roman had to say about you? And this is when Brock made the comment where he said to Paul Heyman, no, Paul, why would I watch this show? I don't watch the show, Paul. And then later on, he told Heyman to go get him a medium well steak with a baked potato and steamed broccoli. Heyman begged him to go out to the ring because Kurt Angle threatened to terminate Paul Heyman's WWE contract if he didn't. And, you know, he made a comment, oh, because we're friends. Just do it because we're friends. Please go out to the ring. And that's when Brock grabbed Paul. He said, we are not friends. You work for me. Go to the ring and do your job. By the way, the first thing I noticed when I saw Brock on this show was that he is clearly taking that USADA testing very seriously. He's got that whole, he's on that Hulk Hogan 1993 diet right now. That's the first thing I noticed. So we'll get back to the Brock stuff. I got more stuff to say about Brock, but we'll get back to that in a second. And just to show people that I didn't hate everything on the show, I actually liked the Baron Corbin-Finn Balor match. I have not been a fan of this feud, and I really don't need this to continue, quite frankly, but they had this long 20-minute match on Monday night, And I think the match was probably 5 or 10 minutes longer than it had to be, and there were too many rest holds. But I actually, down the stretch, I enjoyed the match. I thought that, you know, they were having a good match, and in the end, you know, Corbin got the win. He hit the End of Days. I know there's a lot of people very upset about that when it comes to Finn Balor. What are they doing with this guy? They're burying him. But look, they're trying to get a new guy over. That's why they have Balor working with Corbin. They have Corbin doing the constable thing, and they have high hopes for this guy. And what do you do with a guy like Corbin who isn't the greatest hand they have? You have him work with guys who are great. Finn Balor is a very good wrestler. He's a very talented guy. You don't have to like him. You could think he's too small, but he's very good at what he does. And so if I had somebody like a Baron Corbin and I wanted him to work with somebody and get better, I wouldn't have him working with fucking Titus O'Neil, right? I wouldn't have him working with fucking Bo Dallas. I would have him working with somebody like Finn Balor. So I get that. I can't hate on them for that. And that makes sense. And I'm not a huge fan of the feud, but I enjoyed the match. So there you go. See? I did enjoy something from this show. Even the Lesnar stuff, okay? It was mildly amusing to see him sitting there reading a magazine. But I'll get more into it in a second. The larger aspect of this whole story is one that I just can't get into. I just can't get behind it, and I think it's more damaging than anything else. But elsewhere on the show, we had Alicia Fox. She pinned Natalya. Ronda Rousey was in Natty's corner, and she ended up going after Alexa Bliss and caught her, but then she got away. So they're again, slowly building to you wanting to see Ronda Rousey just rip Alexa her arm right out of the socket, which I expect that she will do at SummerSlam, and she will win the championship. But we had Alicia Fox, who is going to be wrestling Ronda Rousey on Raw tomorrow night. Ronda Rousey is going to make her in-ring Raw singles debut on television tomorrow. It will be against Alicia Fox. I don't expect the match to go very long, but I do think it'll be a good warm-up win for Rousey. And look, I have to say this. I have to give them a lot of credit for the way they've used Rousey so far. I know they did the suspension deal and she was off TV for a month. But Ronda Rousey comes out there and things could have been very differently for them if they would have used her in a different way. The fans could have reacted in a very different way than they have. They could have resented them for it. They could boo Rousey. Boo, you're not one of us. Boo, you only come in when it's convenient for you to come in and you're a celebrity. But they have treated her with respect. She comes out there, they cheer for her, she gets the reaction that Roman Reigns, I'm sure they would kill for Roman Reigns to get that kind of reaction when he comes out. They have handled Rousey very, very well, and they've protected her very, very well since she made her debut. And I think it's important to get her one of these matches on TV so it doesn't just become, well, she only wrestles on pay-per-views, or she only wrestles on big events. Her wrestling on Raw tomorrow night, that's one match more than Brock Lesnar has wrestled on Raw since he came back in 2012. So, you know, I think putting her on TV a few weeks before SummerSlam is a good idea. I think giving her an easy win is a good idea. She's got to go in there and be dominant. She can't go in there and sell for Alicia Fox for 3.5 minutes and then just beat her in the end with a submission. So hopefully that's what they do with her tomorrow night. But I have to, again, applaud them for the way that they've used Rousey because it's in a lot of ways been masterful. She comes out there and gets exactly the kind of reaction that you would want her to get. And Rousey herself has taken to this like a duck to water. She at the beginning she was kind of awkward, and even when she speaks now, she could still kind of be awkward sometimes, but she carries herself like she's been doing this for years. And you would think that she's only going to get better over time. I don't know how long her deal is for. I know in the past she says she wants to start a family and have kids, you know, with her husband. So who knows how long this ride is going to be for her. But I have to give all the parties involved here a lot of credit because I think they've handled her very well. Apollo Crews beat Akam of the Authors of Pain. Why do I mention Apollo Crews beating Akam in a 2-minute match? I mention it because it is the latest evidence that the Authors of Pain are dead. And so for all the praise I can give them about how they've booked and how they've protected Ronda Rousey, they have done the complete opposite with the Authors of Pain. The Authors of Pain and NXT were a dominant force to be reckoned with. They were tag team champions for a long time. They were beating guys left and right. They had Paul Ellering with them to do the talking for them so they didn't have to. And then they called these guys up to the main roster. And what's the very first thing they did on their very first night? They split them up away from Paul Ellering. So now they've taken away their mouthpiece. Maybe because they want them to start talking more on their own. They want them to express themselves more. I think that was a mistake. So that was mistake number one. Mistake number two was after they debuted, they didn't show up again for weeks. Weeks and weeks would go by, and then they show up, and then they'd be off TV again, and weeks would go by. How are people supposed to get accustomed to these guys? How are these guys supposed to get over and establish their moveset and all these different things if they're on TV one week and gone for the next six? So now this is the latest. This is the latest chapter here in their storied career on the main roster so far. Now they're having a one-on-one match against Apollo Crews. Apollo Crews, who has been treated like nothing but a jobber to the stars since he got called up to the main roster. And they lose. He loses to Apollo Crews when he runs. Akam ran into the turnbuckle, into the post, shoulder first. And then Apollo cradled him and pinned him in less than 2 minutes. Oh, well, hey. When I think of the list of ways to get the Authors of Pain over as a dominant force, I think of a schoolboy roll-up at the hands of Apollo Crews. This team is fucked. And I think they have done the exact opposite with them of what they've done with Ronda Rousey, because Rousey is a star and they're not. And so at a time when they desperately need more tag teams and more dominant tag teams, at a time when the fucking B-team are the tag team champions on this show, this is what they're doing to the Authors of Pain. This is ridiculous. So I thought that was stupid. Now, yes, the Authors of Pain could come back, and maybe now Rezar will have a singles match against Titus O'Neil, and he'll beat him, and it'll be 50-50. Again, I ask you, what good does that do? What does that do for the Authors of Pain, even if the other one comes back and gets a quick win tomorrow night on TV? That accomplishes nothing. Other than, I guess, set up a kickoff match for SummerSlam, if these guys are even on the show. Seth Rollins got a DQ win over Drew McIntyre, at least the second time now that he and McIntyre have had a match on TV. And he had the match won, seemingly, I guess we'll never know, with a curb stomp when Dolph Ziggler ran in for the DQ. And Rollins fought off Ziggler, and that was pretty much it. I still, you know, they've officially announced that the title match at SummerSlam is Rollins against Ziggler. But I have every expectation that McIntyre will be added, if not this week, then sometime right before the pay-per-view, because really, it doesn't make any sense to me to just do another straight singles match after the whole batch of them that we've already gotten. Adding McIntyre, who has been directly involved in this whole program and has no match at SummerSlam, he should be part of that match, and frankly, he probably should win the championship, I think is the way that I would go with this. We had Roman Reigns as part of this whole Brock Lesnar storyline. Roman Reigns was waiting very patiently. He was hoping to see Brock Lesnar out in the ring. And it turns out that, you know, Stephanie McMahon wanted Roman removed from the building. And if he didn't leave voluntarily, then he would lose his championship match at SummerSlam. And Kurt Angle came to deliver the news, and Roman was not happy about this. And Baron Corbin was standing there, and he was acting all smug. And so right before he walked out, Reigns just punched Corbin in the face, which was kind of funny. And we never did see Roman Reigns again after that, which leads us to the main event angle, which was Kurt Angle and Baron Corbin coming out, and Angle telling Paul Heyman, look, you better produce your client, because if you don't, it's going to be his last night on Raw, it'll be your last night on Raw. And Heyman was on his hands and knees, and he was begging for his job, and finally, and by the way, in the midst of all this, Kurt Angle referred to Brock Lesnar as the worst Universal Champion of all time. And Brock did come out. He did finally come out. Heyman was very happy. He had this big smile on his face. I knew he would come out. Lesnar comes in, and he ends up giving Kurt Angle an F5, just like old times. Probably the last F5 we'll ever see him give Kurt Angle. And he left him laying, kind of intimidated Corbin, where Corbin left the ring before he could be F5'd. And Heyman is just, he is on cloud nine here, man. He is just smug as shit. He's laughing. He's happy. And so Brock grabs him. He grabs Paul. He assaults Paul Heyman for the first time, I think, since the two of them came back together all these years ago. And he grabs Paul by the, basically by the head, puts him down on the ground. And Paul is saying, I can't breathe. I can't breathe. Brock, let me go. I can't breathe. And so Lesnar, basically, he's an uncaged beast. And even after the show, he did the same thing. He assaulted Mike Rome, who tried to interview him backstage, which just sounds like a terrible idea. I don't know why you would approach a wild Brock Lesnar after what he had just done in the ring to get an interview. There's no other way that could have ended other than Mike Rome being assaulted. And look, I am all for Brock Lesnar going on a rampage and killing people and all that kind of stuff, okay? But I also thought that the Brock Lesnar stuff on this show was a nice little burial of their own product. Because when Brock Lesnar, the character, goes on TV and says that he doesn't watch the show, and you know for a fact that he does not watch the show in real life either, you cannot tell me that this is not art imitating life. So when he says this, and then I see tons of tweets and posts online agreeing with him, agreeing with the sentiment of, why would he watch the show? The show is so bad, why would he watch it? That's not the way I'd have my champion referring to my show. Where is the value in having Kurt Angle call Brock Lesnar the worst Universal Champion of all time, and then having Roman Reigns beat him at SummerSlam? Where is the value in that for Roman? So let's say Roman beats him. Now what? He just beat a man who Kurt Angle called the worst champion we've ever had. Is that supposed to be some kind of big accomplishment when Roman Reigns finally beats him now? Everything they have tried thus far has been a complete failure. They protected the F5 for an entire year. Not one person kicked out of that move. Not Samoa Joe, not Braun Strowman, not AJ Styles. No one. Why? To keep it special. So that when Reigns kicked out of it 6 times at WrestleMania, it would be a big deal. Only for Vince McMahon to turn around and change his mind and have Lesnar win anyway. And what happened the first time that Roman kicked out of that F5 at WrestleMania? Nothing. Nobody cared. It went over like Ric Flair did in all the matches he ever had with Hulk Hogan, which is to say, it didn't. I'd say they lugered Roman Reigns at WrestleMania this year, but at least when Lex Luger walked into SummerSlam in 93, he actually got cheered. It's not his fault that after that whole big push and riding around in a bus for 6 weeks, they decided not to put the title on him. They waited too long. They missed their chance. So here we are again, ready for Reigns-Lesnar 3 or 4 or 5, I've lost track already, in Brooklyn. What do you think is going to happen when they get into the ring that night? That's bad enough. Now we have the narrative that Brock Lesnar is an undeserving champion. He is the worst champion in history of the show. What a great way to build up your SummerSlam main event. What a great victory it'll be for Roman Reigns in Brooklyn if he wins at SummerSlam. That's my biggest issue with this whole thing. Now there's a lot of talk about Paul Heyman after what happened on Monday night. Will he turn on Brock Lesnar? And I answered a mailbag question many, many months ago, and I'm sticking to my guns on this. Do not ever split apart Brock Lesnar and Paul Heyman. If Brock leaves, if Brock legitimately is leaving, and I believe he is, right? One more match and he's going to go get ready for his UFC fight. Doesn't mean he won't come back next year, but I think this is it for Brock. If he leaves and they wanted to keep Paul Heyman around and put him with somebody else, like, for example, Braun Strowman? That, to me, is an intriguing idea. That I could see working. Even though I think if Brock leaves, Heyman is as good as gone. I don't get the impression that they're all that interested, and even Heyman, I'm not so sure how interested he would be in sticking around for anybody other than Lesnar. He's got his own business. I think if Brock goes, so does Paul. But it is an intriguing idea to see maybe if Brock is leaving, if they can, and let's say Strowman gets the championship, he cashes in or whatever, and then they end up aligning Heyman with him, which may well turn him heel by default, but it's an intriguing idea. But I don't think you need to break up Lesnar and Heyman. So Survivor Series 2002, right? He turned on Lesnar. He turned on Lesnar to align with Big Show. I think that would be a mistake. You can still, quote-unquote, split them by having Heyman go with somebody else if Brock is leaving. I don't want to see Paul Heyman and Brock Lesnar turn on each other. They are a perfect pair, and if you're going to at some point bring Brock Lesnar back to this company, and you know there's a very good chance that he will eventually come back, he's got to be with Paul Heyman. We've already seen them do this before, and it was a mistake the first time they did it. You can have Heyman end up with somebody else, but don't have him turn on Brock Lesnar. I don't want to see them do that. I think that would be a mistake. SmackDown was live from Tampa, Florida, over 1,400 votes in the Twitter poll. 76% thumbs up, 24% thumbs down. Literally the inverse of what this week's Raw poll did. I have no idea how this show got 76% thumbs up. Three matches on a two-hour wrestling show does not make this a thumbs-up show. I'm sorry. There was some good stuff on here, but this was hardly a 76% thumbs-up effort. They opened and closed with the women this week. Becky Lynch was interviewed by Renee Young. She was talking about the fact that she hasn't been champion since 2016, and Carmella comes out to cut that very insincere promo about how Becky beat her fair and square the week before, and how the fans don't think she deserves to be champion, and she's very excited to step into the ring with somebody that I respect. And they played Ellsworth's music, which distracts Becky. Becky Lynch, not immune from dumb babyface syndrome. Never take your eye off the other person in the ring just because somebody's music hits. That should be lesson 101. Of course, Carmella attacks her from behind, and she grabs a chair, and that was when Charlotte made her big comeback here on TV for the first time since having her breasts repaired. It's like taking your car into the body shop because somebody slashed your two front tires. She needed some body work. Later, Paige told Carmella that she would be facing Charlotte, and if Charlotte beat her, she would be added to the women's title match at SummerSlam, which is not exactly the news that Becky Lynch was hoping to hear. Now, I see a lot of hate online over this, some of you even referring to Charlotte as the Roman Reigns of the women's division, which is pretty harsh. But you know what? You're not wrong. Those people are not wrong. She has no business getting another title shot having lost twice to Carmella. This was before Money in the Bank. She has not been seen on television in over a month, and suddenly she finds herself in a position to get a title shot at SummerSlam. Don't get me started on her ending Asuka's streak at WrestleMania. Hindsight being what it is, all these months later, I can look back at this objectively now and ask this question. What exactly was accomplished by having her do that? Right? Look at what this woman has done since then. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. She lost to Carmella. Twice. What a waste of a streak. It's all in the follow-up. It's all in the follow-up. Asuka couldn't be unbeaten forever. But, you know, they should have had a plan in place to make it mean something. And I guess they just looked at it as a singular thing. It was a big match at WrestleMania, and Charlotte won, and that's it. Because they sure didn't follow up with Charlotte as though she was a big deal who just ended Asuka's streak. So in WWE, I'm trying to follow the WWE formula here, right? So what they do coming out of WrestleMania is they have Charlotte lose multiple times to Carmella, and then they have Asuka feud with Carmella, and she loses to Carmella as well. Ergo, Carmella is better than both Charlotte and Asuka. I see. On what planet? On the planet Titan, apparently, where there's no oxygen, which would explain the brain damage booking of these women. Having said all of that, my hope, is that by inserting Charlotte into the title picture like this, there is a story, and I assume that is the case here, there is a story that they are building here that leads to a Charlotte heel turn. Because turning Becky Lynch, who the people adore, would be completely stupid. And if they are setting up for a Charlotte-Ronda Rousey match next year, Charlotte should be the heel there anyway, so it kind of feels like the perfect time to do a turn with her. They can tell the story of Charlotte stealing Becky's thunder, if not her title, and either have Charlotte steal the win from her at SummerSlam, and build, because they got to get this belt off Carmella. Carmella has, she's got personality and charisma, and she's done as good a job as she can do, but it's time to move on. You're heading into your Evolution pay-per-view, right? You're going to put your best foot forward with all your top female talent. All due respect, Carmella should not be in that spot. And so I think the time to do a title change would be at SummerSlam. And if they're not going to do the storybook ending of this months-long story that they've been telling with Becky Lynch on her road to redemption and have her win the championship, they could have Charlotte steal the win from her and win the championship and build to a singles match between her and Becky at the Evolution pay-per-view. Or go the other way. Give Becky her moment in Brooklyn, and they can still build to a singles match between them in October. There is a story that is being told here. So let's let it play out. But if they don't turn this woman at some point soon, or they ruin this great story that I think they've been building with Becky for the past few months, then they're making a very big mistake. The Bar beat the Usos to advance to the finals of the tag team tournament. Double splash attempt by Jimmy and Jay was foiled when Cesaro caught Jay with an uppercut coming off the ropes. Jimmy caught a pair of knees to the gut from Sheamus on his way down, got rolled up for the win for the Bar, that is. Bar will face New Day this Tuesday, with the winners facing the Bludgeon Brothers at SummerSlam. I can't say that either one of those matches, if New Day wins or the Bar wins, two heel teams against each other, it doesn't really do much for me. I think they have too many multi-man matches as it is, but in this case, I think it makes sense to have some sort of maybe fatal four-way, where we have New Day, Usos, the Bar, and the Bludgeon Brothers, and maybe make it a fatal four-way elimination match. To me, that's the most interesting thing they could do. Samoa Joe gave an in-ring promo. He brought a stool into the ring so he could sit down. He was sweating profusely, starting to worry about him here. But he talked about, you know, AJ Styles putting the championship before his friends and family. And he said, AJ, as a father, you're a failure. You're not a good husband. Being champion is more important to you than family. And, you know, he said that the ones who will be cheering even more than the fans at SummerSlam when he beats AJ will be AJ's family. Because after he tears down the house that AJ Styles built, his family can have him back. And they promised that AJ will have a response to this on TV this week. Joe is probably the single best promo in this company right now. And so I was not surprised that he came out here and cut a great promo. And so we'll see what AJ's response is and what they do leading up to the match. Obviously bringing family into it brings a personal element. I'm sure AJ will come out and will not be very happy about that next week. And I look forward to the match. Not much else to say. I thought this was exactly what it needed to be. I thought this was great. We had a Jeff Hardy promo in the ring calling out Randy Orton. Randy Orton came down to the ring. Before he could get inside, though, Shinsuke Nakamura attacked Hardy from behind. He went for the Kinshasa, but Orton stepped in the way. Two of them had a little bit of a stare down. Orton then stepped aside and told Shinsuke to go ahead and hit the Kinshasa, which he did. And Nakamura bailed. Orton teased giving Jeff an RKO, but realized that that's exactly what these people want. So instead, he gave Hardy the old Garvin stomp and gave him a draping DDT from the apron to the floor. He ripped off Jeff's chain from around his neck and took it with him as a keepsake. As somebody pointed out to me, they said it reminded them of when IRS... stole the Indian feathers of Tatanka. Or was it Rick Martel? Rick Martel stole the feather as well. I think they did two of the exact same angle, I think, actually. I think they both stole feathers from Tatanka. Or Kama stealing the urn from The Undertaker, melting it down into a chain. I look back at some of those things now. It's just like, I mean, I thought that was ridiculous even then. But it's just, you look back on some of those goofy angles now, and it just makes you shake your head. But anyway, so what Orton is doing here is he is stripping away everything the fans like, right? He's beating up the people the fans like. In this case, he grabbed a towel and a bottle of water, and he started very slowly wiping the face paint off Jeff Hardy's face. He is stripping away everything that the people like. The RKO, they cheer for the RKO, he doesn't give it to him. Jeff's face paint, washing it off. If Orton had the power to do so, he would make Raw a four-hour show. Anything to get these people to hate his guts. Since then, WWE has made the announcement that Jeff will get a rematch for the U.S. title at SummerSlam with Nakamura. I would be shocked if Randy Orton does not get added to make this a triple threat. I think those two secondary title matches at SummerSlam should both be converted to triple threat matches. I think that McIntyre should be added to the U.S. title, or the IC, I should say, title match. And Orton, it would make sense for him to be added to the U.S. title match. Zelina Vega made her in-ring main roster debut against Lana. Lana has improved. She's still not very good, but I think if this were 2 years ago and you said to me that Zelina Vega is going to make her in-ring debut and her opponent will be Lana, I would have probably said a prayer for Zelina. But this wasn't terrible. This was a pretty basic match. I still say that all roads should lead to an intergendered tag match at SummerSlam with Rusev and Lana taking on Andrade and Vega, since there is no other obvious match for these people. So we had Aiden English. I should probably just mention this before I move on here, that Aiden English did come out when Andrade got up on the apron. He came out to yank Cien Almas off the apron. Unfortunately, that distracted Lana, and Lana got rolled up to give Zelina the win. Daniel Bryan came out to address the Miz's attack from last week. But first, he had to plug the all-women's pay-per-view and how proud he is of his wife, Brie. So once we got that out of the way, he called out Miz. Miz wasn't there. Instead, Miz popped up on the Tron. He claimed he was on the set of his reality show, Miz and Mrs. He was in the, of course, in reality, he was backstage. It's like Lee Marshall. When Lee Marshall in WCW, we used to call in with those, was it 1010-321 or 1-800-COLLECT-ROAD-REPORTS he would do. I'm on the road. I'm on location. He was in the fucking broom closet in the back, probably. So, anyway, he challenged, Brian did. He challenged Miz to a match at SummerSlam after insulting Miz and calling him a coward and saying that no matter how hard you try out there in Hollywood, you'll never be The Rock, you'll never even be John Cena. And then he challenged him to a match. And Miz told him, look, why don't you just let your contract expire? Just let your contract expire and go entertain dozens of people in high school gyms. And then he put up a bunch of pictures Miz did of crying babies on the Tron. Photos of some of the people who get upset over the things I tweet, no doubt. That's exactly what they sound like. So that's what they did on this show with these two. Obviously, they're building to a match at SummerSlam. They're not wasting any time. We're not waiting until WrestleMania next year or anything like that. Because apparently, Bryan has still not signed a new deal. I think most people probably expect that he's going to stay put. He does have a wife who works for the company, and I think that has to factor into his decision as well. Although, if I'm him, you know, I'm going to make the decision that is going to make me the happiest. Where am I going to be the most happy? Where am I going to make the most money? He's got a wife. He's got a kid. I don't get the impression that money is the most important thing to him. And honestly, I think he's in the pole position right now because Bryan could leave the company and not make as much money on the indies, as you will in WWE, but he'll make a damn good living for himself. You can't tell me that if Bryan leaves and goes to work for Ring of Honor, or goes to work in New Japan, or goes to work in Mexico, goes to work anywhere he wants, that he won't be able to command top dollar. And I don't even know that he would. I don't think he's going to be going out there saying, well, my rate is, $10,000 a match, take it or leave it. I don't even think, he doesn't strike me as even being that kind of guy. So I don't think money is really much of an issue for him right now, because he's going to make a damn good living for himself wherever he goes. He is going to be the most sought-after commodity in wrestling. He'll go all over the world. He'll have work for the next 5 years if he wants it. I think it boils down to, where does he feel he would be the happiest? Are there people out there that he wants to work with that he can't work with if he stays in WWE? You know, maybe. Maybe a lot of those guys will end up in WWE. Nakamura did. Right? There are people that Bryan has wanted to work with who are now in WWE, and he still hasn't had the chance to work with Nakamura. So, look, that could be a factor too. Now, imagine if Bryan leaves, and then in January, Nakamura leaves. And they have a match, but it's in New Japan. Can you imagine that? It could happen. It could very well happen. You could have... Now, imagine this. Now, this is... I'm just fantasy pie in the sky here. But if the rumors are true, Bryan, let's say, has yet to re-sign, and Nakamura's contract is coming up at the beginning of next year, you could very well have a situation where you could have Daniel Bryan against Shinsuke Nakamura at Madison Square Garden in April, WrestleMania weekend, for a company not named WWE. Think about that. You don't think that would be a big main event or a big co-main event to have on a show like that at the Garden? You don't think that would help sell tickets to Madison Square Garden? Tickets for that show, by the way, go on sale this week. If you're an Honor Club member, this Wednesday, you'll have access to the MSG tickets, and they go on sale Friday morning to the general public. I'm pretty sure I'm going to go to that show. I have no doubt that NXT that night is going to be phenomenal. It always is. But I'm probably going to be at the Garden, like a lot of other people will. But yeah, I mean, you just, until Bryan resigns, I mean, there's so many different possibilities. And so what do you do for SummerSlam? He's got this match with Miz, and the show is still a couple of weeks away. How late in the game are we going to get here before he signs off on a new deal? Because he's probably in no rush. He's under no pressure. He's in no rush. He's going to work on his own timetable. So he may well go into SummerSlam still without a new deal. And if that's the case, I don't see how Bryan wins that match. And I wouldn't blame WWE at all for having him put The Miz over. Even though this feud has been going on for so long that you would think and hope that the end result is that Bryan gets, you know, his big win and his big comeuppance on The Miz. But if he hasn't re-signed a new contract and he may be out the door, well, then why should he beat Miz? They got to keep somebody strong who's going to be with them going forward. So as a fan, I'm torn because there's still a lot of names on this roster, you know, in WWE, NXT, that Bryan could work with that he either hasn't for many years or has never had the chance to work with. I would love one day to be able to see a real proper feud with him and AJ. I'd love to see him against, you know, Cien Almas. There are people in NXT right now. You know, Matt Riddle is probably on his way in. Daniel Bryan against Matt Riddle one day. That sounds like a fun match. You know, Velveteen Dream. Or, I mean, there's a lot of different possibilities here. But I also look at the indie scene and what's going on elsewhere and in Japan and other places. And man, it's, you know, it's really, I don't know, as a fan, where do I want this guy to end up? It's tough to say, you know, probably for his health, in all honesty, he should probably stay where he is. But you start thinking, if you're him, I don't know, you know, where his head is at. He probably wants to go out there and would love to have the kind of matches he used to have. And, he may have to leave WWE in order to do that. Look, I said before, and then I'll end on this though, but I said, a few months ago that if I were him, I would be worried that one even minor concussion, he's always one injury away from WWE revoking his wrestling privileges. And maybe he's okay with that. Maybe that's the agreement that he reached with, you know, his wife and the company. And look, you're right. If I get hurt, I shouldn't be wrestling anymore and I'll step away. And thankfully that hasn't happened yet. But the company is not going to take any chances here. And so even a, quote, minor injury, what happens if he gets hurt and they say, well, that's it. We gave you a chance. You got hurt. We can't let you wrestle. But now the guy is locked into a 2-year deal or a 3-year deal. If I were him, I would argue for some kind of a clause, like an out clause in the contract that says, look, if this happens, you have to let me go. And that would be almost like a little insurance policy for him, where if something happened and the company was giving him, you know, giving him grief again, he could say, you know what? I'm not interested in fighting with you. I'm going to step aside and go wrestle somewhere else. So I wonder if maybe he would ask for some kind of assurance like that in his contract. I don't know. But I'm as curious as anybody to see, you know, what decision he makes. I do think, though, in the end, he's going to stay right where he is. Main event on this show was Charlotte against Carmella. There was an ugly spot early where Carmella was outside and Charlotte went to do a plancha out to the floor, but she landed awkwardly. And she got a lot of crap for it online, and, well, people saying she shouldn't be doing these moves, this is why. And I watched this again. That was 100% on Carmella. Carmella was out of position. All the people shitting on Charlotte for it need to get their eyes checked, because that was clearly Carmella just not being where she was supposed to be. Charlotte won after she countered a figure four attempt into the figure eight for the tap out win. So Charlotte is officially added to the women's championship match at SummerSlam. She makes it a three-way with Becky and Carmella. And they're playing it up that Becky Lynch is very clearly not thrilled about this. There is a story here, and it needs to play out, like I said before, with Charlotte going back heel again in the end. It's the right thing to do, and it sets up a singles match with her and Becky for Evolution. Now, I asked you guys to let me know when Miz's dad showed up on that Miz and Mrs. reality show. I watched episode one last week. I said, I don't know if I'm going to stick with it. And I said, look, let me know when Miz's dad shows up, because the guy's a character, and I like Miz's dad. And it didn't take very long, because he popped up on the second episode, so I watched it. And if Chris Jericho could get Ralphus over in WCW, there is no reason that Miz can't get his dad over as his manager in WWE. Come on. Come on. Maurice is at home with the baby now. He doesn't have the Miztourage anymore. Now is the time for George Mizanin to make his SmackDown Live debut. Miz and Maurice on this episode were throwing a baby shower, or I should correct myself, Maurice was throwing a baby shower. I have enough married friends to know that that's how this really works. It ain't the guys putting this thing together. They're just sort of along for the ride. So they went cake shopping. She wanted, of course, the most expensive cake. And on the show, maybe he's like this in real life too, but on the show, they sort of portray Miz as being very frugal with his money. So he goes for the slightly less expensive one. And he negotiates the $100 delivery charge down to $90. Ooh, he's quite the negotiator. If it was him as the negotiator in that movie instead of Samuel L. Jackson, he would have been dead in the first scene. So then Miz has to go pick his dad up at the airport. Maurice is back at the house getting her hair done and getting ready for the big party. And they're moving out of Chateau Miz. Or I guess they, what do they call it? Chateau Marmiz? Ugh. It's like Bennifer. Right? Remember Bennifer? What was the other name? It was, I think that was. That was Ben Affleck and Jennifer Lopez, right? Bennifer, they called them? All these stupid names they come up with. So, yeah, Chateau Marmiz is what they call their house. They're moving, of course, out to Texas, and this is their big sort of going away party. So she's at home, and Miz picks his father up from the airport. And his father is even cheaper than he is. He says, well, why pay any delivery fee at all? Let's just go pick up the cake. And he's not wrong, by the way. So against his better judgment, Miz agrees, and I think you could all figure out what happens next. They put the cake in the car, and then Miz stops short, and the cake goes flying forward. So now it's ruined, and he ends up rushing back to the cake shop, and he pays double. He offers to pay double the price of the most expensive cake. So if the most expensive cake was a grand, I'll pay you $2,000, he says. Because that's the cake that my wife wanted. You just have to get it for me ASAP. I need it right now. So, fast forward. We're at the house for the party. This glorious cake is delivered. Miz's mother suspects foul play is involved here. When the more expensive cake is delivered. And she takes Maurice to Mike's car, where they find cake residue all over the back seat. As if he would not have cleaned that shit up. And that's on the inside of the car. Like, if a bird shits on my car, which they do every day because there's a giant tree that hangs over my driveway, I lose my mind. There's no way that Miz is leaving cake all over the inside of his car. Yeah. That's the story of my life. Bird crap. Bird crap and tree sap. That's going to be the title of my first song when I take off as a SoundCloud rapper. I take it to the car wash. The very next day, there's bird crap all over it. And there's tree sap all over the back window. I remember the first time I looked at the back window, I thought it was water. I took a tissue. I went to go wipe it off, and it stuck to the window. I said, what is this? Is this honey? No, it's tree sap all over the car. You can barely see out the back window. This is what I've been putting up with all summer. Bird crap and tree sap. Like, I want a new car, but I'm terrified to buy one because I know as soon as I bring it home, it's going to be covered in all this crap. I have a Hyundai Sonata right now. Same year as I started this podcast. So that, what's that? 11 years. 11 years. Car only has 57,000 miles on it, which is not bad, I think, for an 11-year-old car. But I've been eyeing, because I've been starting to do my research, and I've been eyeing one of those Honda Civic hatchbacks in blue, 2018 Civic hatch. That's the one I've been reading up on lately. Not that I've made my mind up yet, but that's the one I'm sort of leaning towards. I mean, but I'm hardly a car guy, so believe me, any suggestions are welcome out there from any of you car people. I really like, I'll tell you what, I really like the Type R. But there's absolutely no reason for me to be driving one of those things where I live. Like, maybe if I lived in a more suburban area or a place with more open road, not in the middle of Brooklyn, I'm not going to buy, you know, a Type R. But what's the point? Because the Angry Birds are just going to repaint it in white for me anyway, so there's no point. Maybe I should buy a white car, then nobody would notice. So yeah, this all felt very contrived, but I know that's how all these reality shows are, which is why I usually don't watch them. It was fun, though, seeing John Morrison was at the baby shower, Taya, I saw her in the background, Dolph was there, Dana Brooke was there, and fucking Avril Lavigne. Not that Dana Brooke was fucking Avril Lavigne, I just meant fucking Avril Lavigne was at this friggin' party. I'm like watching this, I'm like, what the hell? Like, talk about random. And there she is. There's just like, oh, there's Avril Lavigne. But truth be told, look, the show's only half an hour. I enjoyed this more than I did Raw. I may have to watch this show more often. Half an hour with commercials, it's probably like 23, 24 minutes. Easy watch. I can't complain.
Hey, Sell the Monster Sounds Off podcast listeners, I'm Wade Keller from Pro Wrestling Torch. Maybe you've heard me on the Steve Austin Show on a regular basis, recapping pay-per-views. Well, now you can hear me four times per week. I do a post-Raw and post-SmackDown show called the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. We have a co-host, including, on a regular basis, Jason Solomon himself. Plus, live callers, our mailbag segment, and an on-site correspondent. And then later in the week, my podcast One Shows feature the Thursday flagship and interview Friday. Check them out. Search Wade Keller in Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or anywhere that you listen to Pro Wrestling Podcast.
NXT this past week, Heavy Machinery got a win over the Mighty when the Street Profits ran out into the crowd in the middle of the match to party with the fans. And this distracted the Mighty and gave Heavy Machinery the chance to hit the compactor for the win. I would love to party with Montez Ford. He strikes me as the kind of guy who would be a lot of fun to hang out with. Mustache Mountain got a win over Default Team Number 1, Brandon Taylor, and Matt Knotts. Tyler Bate is just, he's so friggin' smooth to watch in that ring. It's a pleasure to watch him. All of his matches, I just enjoy them thoroughly. So Trent Seven got Taylor up in the torture rack position while Bate came off the top rope with a knee drop for the win. And after the match, Trent Seven apologized to the Full Sail crowd for losing the tag team titles. And Tyler Bate said that I threw the towel in because my partner's health and well-being are more important than any championship victory. Could these men possibly be any more of a babyface team? Like, they were just out there. How can you not like these guys? So Bate said, look, I spoke to William Regal. We are invoking our rematch clause for TakeOver Brooklyn, and everybody cheered. We've come a long way from the days in Full Sail where they would say, at TakeOver in Brooklyn or in Chicago or wherever. And because it wasn't Full Sail, they would boo. That used to happen. Now at least they cheer. So we've made some progress in that respect. Later on backstage, the War Raiders confronted Mustache Mountain and warned them that they were going to be next in line for those tag team titles. And I will say that for two wild Vikings, they're actually very articulate people. EC3 beat Kona Reeves with the one percenter. You know, Kona Reeves gets a lot of shit, and it is well-deserved. He is pretty bad. But people need to remember, it is NXT. And as much as NXT now is a glorified indie promotion, and it is also still a place for these younger guys to learn and improve. And so I say, let's give this guy some time before we write him off into the dustbin of wrestling history. Velveteen Dream interrupted the match and invited EC3 to enter Dream's world before walking off to the back. EC3 still won the match. He did not fall victim to dumb babyface syndrome. He still won, and later on, EC3 accepted Dream's challenge to a match at TakeOver. Then we got a great battle. This was the highlight of NXT this week, and really one of the highlights, I think, of any WWE show all week. Shayna Baszler, non-title match against Candice LeRae. This was Candice's best match since coming to NXT. Just a well-worked match. Baszler plays the bully very well. Candice is as good as anybody at playing the underdog. Baszler got a bloody nose during this match. It was very physical. I love the little callback to their match from last year in the Mae Young Classic where Candice went for her swinging neck breaker off the ropes, and on the way down, Shayna transitioned it into a rear naked choke. They did the same spot here, only this time Candice was able to get the ropes. Candice hit an unprettier. She went for the quebrada off the ropes, but Baszler rolled out of the way and hit a penalty kick, and then right back into the choke for the submission win. Hell of a match between these two. Definitely worth taking 10 minutes or so to check it out. Baszler attacked her after the match, put her back in the choke until Kairi Sane ran down to make the save. Baszler back down. But then when Kairi turned to go tend to Candice, Shayna ran back over, shoved Kairi down. Kairi then, they got this great close-up shot of her face. She just snapped. And she tried to go after Shayna. She got held back by the referees. And Baszler is so easily hateable. And Candice and Kairi are probably two of the most likable females on the roster. It just makes for great TV. So I think Baszler is doing such a good job as champion in this role. I would have her retain in Brooklyn. I mean, you've got the Mae Young Classic finals coming up. I mean, the tournament itself, I think, is actually being taped this week. The finals won't take place until the Evolution pay-per-view at the end of October. But you've got the Mae Young Classic coming up, and, you know, this pay-per-view, they're going to have a strong NXT women's title defense on there as well. I think Baszler should be facing whoever the Mae Young Classic winner is down the road. But on that pay-per-view, she should also be the one defending that championship against the solid babyface challenger, whomever that may be. And I don't know if that's a multi-person match. Bianca Belair is in the wings. Bianca Belair is great. She's a heel, so I don't know about doing heel on heel. It might be too early for that, but I would definitely keep that title on Shayna for a while. Maybe even into next year, frankly. I would be in no rush to get that belt off of her. I think she's been doing a pretty good job. William Regal announced that Adam Cole and Ricochet will meet for the North American Championship in Brooklyn. This was a backstage segment with audio worse than mine when I recorded my very first podcast 11 years ago. I don't know what was going on here. He was not mic'd up well at all. This was almost like a spur of the moment. Hey, let's do a quick segment. And they didn't do a sound check or something. I don't know. It just struck me. We're so used to, like, the polished video and the polished audio on these shows with this company that when you get a segment like this, it's almost jarring. So we close the show with Tommaso Ciampa, the new NXT champion, coming out to the best theme song a heel could ask for, the sounds of hatred and contempt from the audience. And my favorite part of this was him going, as he was talking, and he gets out of the ring, and there's a granny, older woman, in the front row, and he goes over and he taunts the granny in the front row. Sadly, she didn't take a swing at him the way that that stunt granny did on Nitro that time when she took a swing at Hollywood Hogan, tried to punch him in the face. I just remember watching that, and you could see in the background, Doug Dillinger, who was the head of security for WCW, he's watching this. He's not doing anything. And it may well have been planned as part of the show, but he's just standing there, he's got this look on his face, just watching this, like, really? Really, lady? What are you trying to do here? We need more stunt grannies in wrestling. That's what we're missing. Aleister Black comes down, and as he's coming down to the ring, Johnny Gargano blows right past him, sprints down to the ring, and goes after Ciampa. Ciampa bails. Johnny's on the microphone. He keeps saying, the only reason you're champion right now is because of me. The only reason you're champion right now is because of me. He says it three times, and he turns around, and he gets kicked right in the face. Black mask kick from Aleister Black. Followed by chants that I never thought I would hear Johnny Gargano get here at Full Sail. But here, Johnny Gargano, maybe the best pure babyface that this company has, is kicked in the face and laid out, and he gets chants of, you deserve it. And I thought this was great. This is all part of the story that they're telling here. Johnny Gargano, even though he's a babyface and everybody likes him, he has lost his mind. He has allowed Tommaso Ciampa and his success to get to him, to get in his head. Tommaso Ciampa is living rent-free inside this guy's head, and it is driving him insane. And frankly, Johnny Gargano did cost Aleister Black the championship, and he did deserve to get kicked in the face. So him getting those you deserve a chance were well-deserved. Doesn't mean that, they're burying Gargano, or what are they doing? They're telling a story here. This guy is just obsessed. and he has to get his mind right. And in the end, people will want to see him win that championship. So I thought, you know, the way they've handled this whole thing, I think, has been very, very well done. Unfortunately, it could be undone by an injury. There could be a change in plans with this TakeOver main event, which it has not yet officially been announced, but I don't see how it isn't a triple threat match with these three. And unfortunately, what happened is they had a match. There was a singles match between Aleister Black and Tommaso Ciampa at a house show last weekend. I guess they were out in Vegas. And Aleister Black got crotched on the top rope by Ciampa. And he was hurt bad enough that he had to undergo surgery. He may have literally busted a nut. And given that TakeOver is less than 2 weeks away, and there's a visual for you, by the way. And given that TakeOver is less than 2 weeks away, that's a pretty quick turnaround, I think, if he does make it back in time. The thing is, though, if you're going to do a three-way match, then that's to his advantage, because you could always hide him. You can take him out early on. They do something to him, double-team him. He's laid out. He doesn't have to do much. And Ciampa and Gargano can carry the load, kind of the way the Triple H and Rock did in that three-way at SummerSlam in 2000 when Kurt Angle, unfortunately, the table broke on that pedigree attempt, and he got knocked loopy. I think that may have been the plan anyway for him to sort of be hurt and be out of the match, although I don't think they expected him to get legit hurt the way that he did. But you could think of a gazillion, I'm sure, other examples of triple threat matches that follow the same formula. One guy gets taken out, the other two take over. So unless his injury is that serious where he just can't be cleared, if it's a three-way, you can still have him in that match and you can hide him enough where you don't really have to disrupt your plans. And, maybe Triple H can loan him his biker shorts that he wore years ago when he tore his groin. Remember that? Biker short Triple H, by far his worst look. We'll see. Hopefully it doesn't really impact. There were some people floating the idea, Matt Riddle. Matt Riddle's going to probably make his debut that night. He'll wave to the crowd. Why not have him as a surprise and insert him into the match? Hey, I'm sure it would be a fantastic match. It wouldn't make any fucking sense storyline-wise. This guy just walks in and gets a championship match. But by all means, please, continue to fantasy book. These are the same people who would probably complain about the exact same thing if it was done on Raw. This doesn't make sense. Why does Roman get this title shot? Why is Charlotte, she's the Roman Reigns of the women's division? But they have no problem. Oh, well, let's just put Matt Riddle in the championship match. Oh, yeah, sure, that makes a lot of sense. Like, do you hear yourself? No, I don't think Matt Riddle will end up in this match, nor should he. Although that would be a hell of a match, I'm not going to lie. Lucha Underground, episode 8, I believe, is what we are up to here. We had Daga with Cobra Moon beating PJ Black with some sort of crucifix wrist lock submission. Matt Stryker said something about a wrist lock, and he wanted to see a replay, but we don't get no stinking replays here in Lucha Underground. You either watch it or you don't. You miss it, too bad. Out comes Drago after the match and Vibora. Johnny Mundo, though, comes out with Taya to make the save. Cobra Moon starts cutting a promo on them, and Johnny says, look, you want me so bad? Come and get me. And this leads to an 8-person tag team match being set up for the show this coming Wednesday. If the Reptile Tribe beats the Worldwide Underground, Johnny Mundo must join the Reptile Tribe. And if the Worldwide Underground wins, then Cobra Moon will grant Johnny one wish. So she's a genie now. I want Mundo to win so he can wish for Raw to go back to 2 hours. That's what I want. The Mac was backstage preparing for his trios match when Katrina shows up in her red dress. She warns him that Mil Muertes is coming to kill him. And the Mac says, look, Mil scares me. But if he tries anything, I'm going to drop him. And Katrina pops open the door to one of the lockers next to Max and just walks away. And Mac looks inside the locker, and what he finds is a skull complete with eye patch and cigar. And talk about old story, which obviously is supposed to be Big Rick, because he used to be a character on the show many moons ago. But talk about old storylines. We have not seen Big Rick since season 1. And in those, remember those comic books they did? There was like 4 comics that they did that had like the Disciples of Death in there, and I think I don't know if it advanced any storylines, but I think it helped explain the backstory to some stuff that we didn't get on TV. And in the comic books, it was revealed that, to us, that the Disciples of Death killed Big Rick. So I guess actually it did advance at least one storyline. They killed Big Rick, which is why we never saw him again. And the Disciples of Death, of course, belong to Katrina. So a bit of storyline continuity here. But that's got to suck, though, right? To look in your locker and find your dead cousin's skull. But his reaction, Mac's reaction to this was great, though. He's like, he looks in there, he goes, "Oh, shit, Big Rick!" I do love how he can accurately identify the identity of the human skull just by the fact that it has an eye patch and a cigar in its mouth. Like, Benson and Stabler could have used Mac's help, I think, on SVU a time or two. Dragon Azteca Jr. cut a promo in the ring about winning the Gift of the Gods title last week. He says he'll defend it against anybody, and he plans to cash in for a Lucha Underground title match at Ultima Lucha 4. Yeah, he's not making it to Ultima Lucha with that title. That was my thought anyway, coming out of this. I thought it was bizarre that he even won that match last week. Now he's out here talking about, "I'll defend it against all comers." Yeah, that doesn't sound like a very good idea to me, but good luck with that. Killshot, the Mac, and Son of Havoc retain their trios titles against the Rabbit Tribe. Rabbit Tribe has not had a lot of luck since we saw the debut of the leader, I guess, of the White Rabbit Tribe, the Killer Cross guy. We saw him once. We haven't seen him on TV since. And they've been losing. So Mac hit a frog splash to, I think it was Mala Suerte, but Killshot stole the pin. And Mac seemed bothered by this. And I'm watching this. I'm like, dude, like, you're on the same team. This guy's been angry at you for weeks. Just let it go. Don't antagonize him anymore. Just let it go. You won the match. What is there to be upset about? It was supposed to be Pentagon and Cage, each selecting a partner of their choice for a tag team match. Cage chose King Cuerno. But Pentagon said, "I don't need no partner. I'll fight you both all by myself," which did not seem like the wisest choice for him to make. And in fact, I was right. Cuerno hit the thrill of the hunt on Pentagon. And Cage then said, "Look, leave, please." And Cuerno obliged, and he left. And Cage then picked up Pentagon for a suplex, gave him a Steiner screwdriver for the win. And that should be enough, I guess, to earn him another championship match. He gave Pentagon a concerto when the match was over. And the show ended. This was something. The show ended with a very goofy Indiana Jones skit involving Taya and Johnny Mundo. Mundo, by the way, I forgot to mention this before. He's going to be out for a while. I mean, it shouldn't affect this show because this show was already taped. But he just dislocated his elbow. He hurt himself during a photo shoot for Muscle and Fitness magazine. Apparently he was doing what they call the Kong to Cat move, which is some kind of parkour move. But he was wearing baby oil, and I guess he either slipped or landed wrong, and he dislocated his elbow. So that sucks. I had no idea what Kong to Cat even was. I just pictured Awesome Kong talking to Ernest Miller on a walkie-talkie or something. But I watched a video of that move on YouTube, Kong to Cat. I would be terrified to even try it. Honestly, everything about parkour scares the hell out of me. It's fun to watch, like other people do it, but ain't no way in hell I'd ever be dumb enough to try it. I mean, I fucking walk through glass doors for crying out loud. What do you think would happen to me if I tried one of those moves? Are you kidding me? I'm going for surgery in a few weeks because I walked into a friggin' door. He and Taya, they were dressed up like something out of The Last Crusade. When they found Cobra Moon's reptile lair. So they were trying to break into the reptile lair. And we see Drago. We don't see Cobra Moon anywhere, but Drago is chained to a wall. And then we see Vibora. And Vibora kicks Taya in the face, knocks her out. Then he tried to choke out Johnny Mundo. And as he's doing so, and Mundo is fading, Taya wakes up. She picks up the giant sword that she had with her, which she had dropped on the floor. Or at least I think. I'm pretty sure she had it on her already. But anyway, she picks this giant sword up off the floor. And she proceeds to... first she puts Vibora down. She hits him with like the butt end of it or whatever. And then she decapitates Vibora. This guy had such a good match on TV a few weeks ago. And then they go and they kill him off. Yet another murder. Mundo says, as they quickly go to leave, Mundo says to Drago, "We were never here." And then they quickly fled. So the kills continue on this show. They're not going to have much of a roster left if this keeps up. But I was actually kind of disappointed because I just, on this podcast, I was praising this great match that Vibora had. This was a breakout performance. I hope they do more with him. And then he gets his fucking head chopped off. Man, I didn't see that coming. I did not see that coming. So anyway, that was Lucha Underground. Let's get to your mailbag questions. I got a bunch of them here. I pulled up a whole bunch of your questions to get to this week. You can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. I do read everything that you guys send to me. I just can't use them all. But you can email me there. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Chase from Las Vegas. I know this will not happen, but I was thinking that it might be best for the Universal title match to open the SummerSlam pay-per-view. That way, people see a potentially good opening match and get all of their hatred out of their system at the beginning rather than waiting 3 to 4 hours just to boo their hearts out. Do you think putting Roman versus Brock on first would be a good idea? This is actually something I brought up the last time I did Wade Keller's show, the week before last. There's probably no chance. I won't say there's no chance. There's probably no chance of that happening. But in front of that crowd in Brooklyn, I think opening with that match and ending with the WWE title match between AJ Styles and Samoa Joe is a good idea. And in storyline, they can say that Brock wanted the match to go on first so that he can leave early and fly home quicker. And that would get him even more heat, at least in theory. I mean, I think he'll be booed that night. But just because Brock Lesnar is going to get booed or get a mixed reaction in Brooklyn does not automatically mean that Roman Reigns is going to be cheered, right? So the fear is that you end up with a situation like we had at WrestleMania this year, where both guys are hated and the fans just decide to hijack the match and they bust out the beach balls and it's just one big party and nobody pays attention to what's going on in the ring. Well, I don't know about you, but I would rather, like you said, these people get this shit out of their system early. Plus, it's a big match to open the show. You might actually get a better, louder reaction putting it on early than you would saving it for 3.5 hours. So why not? They have 2 top titles. That's the beauty of having more than 1 top title. There should only be 1, but they have 2. Well, you can put 1 on first and put 1 on last. Put the Universal title on first and save the WWE Championship for later. Unless, and this is the one reason that I would not do it. If this is the plan, then I would not put this match on first. If their plan, and I think it probably is to have Braun Strowman cash in his Money in the Bank at SummerSlam and win the championship, then now either making it a triple threat match where he comes in at the beginning and says, "Look, I'm cashing in now," and it becomes a three-way, or if he waits like everybody else does until the very end, either way, if the plan is for him to cash in and for him to win the championship, then you have to save that for the end of the show. Then I think at that point you have no choice. If the idea is just Brock wins, LOL, or Roman finally gets his big crowning moment, then open the show with it and just be done with it. But if Strowman's cashing in, then it has to be later in the show after Strowman has already had his match with Kevin Owens. Kevin, in Albany, New York, is WWE Evolution the thing that ends up bringing CM Punk back to WWE? I'm not saying he appears at the event, but rather his wife, AJ Lee, if she does, that could start dialogue between Phil, Paul, Stephanie. I love how we're all on first name basis here. Phil, Paul, Stephanie, and Vince. If Stephanie McMahon and WWE are as genuine as they want the public to believe they are about this women's evolution, they should be doing everything they can to mend fences with AJ Lee and get her to appear at the Evolution pay-per-view. While Bayley, Sasha, Becky, and Charlotte, and others were turning in great ring work during the beginning, it was AJ Lee as the voice of change on the main roster. I would hope CM Punk is not so bitter and selfish to not allow his wife to have her moment that I'm sure she really wants. Wow, there is a lot to unpack here. I don't even know where to begin. First of all, mend fences with AJ Lee. I don't know what you're talking about there, because the issue was always with Punk and WWE, not with AJ. So AJ did not leave on bad terms. AJ does not have beef with the company. So there's no fences to mend. You either just invite her or you don't. So I don't really understand the whole mending fences thing. And, you know, the other thing about Punk being so, you know, bitter and selfish not to allow his wife, I don't think he cares. You know, if his wife wanted to do something, he would let her do it. And frankly, it's not a matter of him letting her do anything. She's her own person. She could do whatever the fuck she wants. She doesn't answer to him. Right? That's stupid. And the last point, you know, I would like for her to get the moment that she really wants. How do you know that she wants that? We don't know that she wants to be there. I mean, I would think that she probably does, but she may just be happy, you know, as he is, to be divorced from the wrestling business. I'm not saying you're wrong. I just don't think that we should assume that AJ is sitting by the phone at home dying, waiting for their call so that she could be a part of this pay-per-view. I do think that WWE absolutely should reach out to her and extend the invitation, even if they get no response or if they're turned down. They should absolutely extend the invitation for her to at least make an appearance. She was as much a part of that whole women's revolution thing as any of those other names that you mentioned. She was the only one of them to ever call out Stephanie McMahon on Twitter when it came to equal pay with the men and ratings and merch sales and all of that stuff. Right? She was the one to go out and do that. Nobody else had the guts to do that, but she did. And maybe it was because she knew, I'm not long for this company. My husband is fighting and feuding with them, and I'm probably got one foot out the door. AJ probably knew she was on her way out. She probably felt more empowered to say something, whereas if Alicia Fox did the same thing, it probably wouldn't end well for Alicia Fox. But she still did it. Nobody else did. AJ did. And that took guts. Now, I doubt CM Punk would do anything to stand in her way if she wanted to make an appearance. I think he wants his wife to be happy, and so if she wants to do it, she'll do it. She doesn't need his permission. That's assuming, of course, that she's invited, which if she isn't, I think is just a petty move by a petty company. But it also isn't going to bring CM Punk back to WWE, to go back to your original point. It ain't going to work at all. Even if AJ shows up, she shows up and waves, or she wrestles, it will not be the start of any sort of dialogue. I don't believe that for a second. He has no interest in working with those people. This women's pay-per-view, AJ or no AJ, will do nothing to change that. Andy, from Bolivia, you've got a banging show. I have been catching up with all the wrestling I've been missing since 2013 with your show. It's the perfect gym companion. So, thank you to Andy. Kurt Angle called Brock the worst Universal Champion ever last Monday, with only four Universal Champions so far, that being Finn Balor, Kevin Owens, Goldberg, and Brock Lesnar. Do you agree with him? And what would be your ranking of the Universal Champions thus far? To be honest with you, they've all been pretty awful. You know, Finn Balor, I guess, by default, would be the worst because he never even defended the thing once. He won it, he got hurt, and he gave it up the next night. Then, after him, I'd probably put Goldberg, then Brock, and I guess I would rank Kevin Owens as the best, just because I can at least remember some really good title defenses that he had against Seth Rollins. Against Roman Reigns, you know, the match that he and Roman Reigns had at the Alamo Dome that year at the Royal Rumble was really good. Now, Brock has had great matches as well, don't get me wrong. I mean, I enjoyed the match with Samoa Joe, even though it was kind of disappointing at the end there. The match with AJ Styles, I thought, was one of the matches of the year last year, the match they had at Survivor Series. So it's not like Brock has not had any good matches as the Universal Champion. I would go with Owens, but that's faint praise because I don't think we've really had anybody who honestly has had a truly great run as the Universal Champion. Even Kevin Owens. Look at the way they booked him as the champion. He was playing second fiddle to everybody else. He had one of those 2002 Jericho runs with the belt. He was never, even as champion, he was never really positioned as the top guy on the brand. The guy was treated like an afterthought even when he was the champion. So believe me, his run was no great shakes either. But I think it's slim pickings when you look at the Universal champions we've had so far. I would go with Kevin Owens, though, as the best of the bunch. Chris, in Cortland, New York. I was wondering if you knew of any heat that Lisa Marie Verone, a.k.a. Victoria, might have with WWE. And for that matter, Melina as well. It seems strange to me that with all the respect being paid to the women's division lately, that neither have been included in any of it. We have the 25th anniversary of Raw, pay tribute to the women as well as the first ever Women's Royal Rumble match. Now with the All-Women's Evolution pay-per-view on the horizon and talk of women like Trish and Lita being on the show, it stands to reason that Victoria and Melina should be part of that. Do you know if are there any issues WWE might have with either woman that would have precluded their returns? It's a very strange thing with Victoria. She's never mentioned. And last year at SmackDown, the night they had that Women's Money in the Bank rematch on TV, she wanted to go backstage. She was there, I guess, in town or outside the building or whatever, and she wanted to go backstage. Because they always let talent backstage, even talent that doesn't even work for WWE. People are backstage all the time. If you're a worker, if you're a wrestler, you pretty much get back there. And she claimed anyway, and this is her side of the story, but she claimed that the office would not even let her go backstage to visit or to congratulate the women. They wouldn't even let her in the back. Raw 25, like you said, came and went. No Victoria. The Women's Royal Rumble match came and went. No Victoria. WWE.com this week, they put a poll up asking which former superstar would you like to see return at the Evolution pay-per-view. 12 names were on that list, okay? AJ Lee! I just got done talking about AJ. AJ Lee was on that list. Alundra Blaze, Molly Holly, a bunch of others. No Victoria. And no Melina, for that matter. And the only thing I can think of, the one common thing between the two of them, and I hate to even bring this up, but it's the only thing I could think of, were those nude photos that leaked. Was it last year, I think? For the both of them. They both had, like, nude photo leaks, and they were hardly the only ones. But they were sort of swept up in that. And look, I mean, we all know what happened with Paige, and not only was Paige not blackballed or fired or anything, she's now the general manager of SmackDown. So that would not be a very good reason to blackball anybody, you know, if that were true. I really don't have a better answer than that for you. Unless their reps, you know, their reputations were just such that they were difficult to work with. You know, other than the leaked photo stuff, I can't think of one good reason not to pick up the phone and ask them to be part of this in some way, or at least acknowledge them, at least acknowledge Victoria. It's like the woman never even existed. Isaac, from London, Ontario, with Shinsuke Nakamura's contract reportedly expiring in early 2019, do you think he should stay with WWE or make a return to New Japan Pro Wrestling? Nakamura will be 39 years old next year. I think he should go wherever he can get himself the best deal. He won't be as beat up if he sticks around. I mean, the schedule, I'm sure, is way worse with WWE, but he's not having the kind of matches in WWE that he had in New Japan. And some people probably want him for that reason to go back to New Japan, but he's not having those same hard-hitting, just physically taxing, brutal matches that he had in New Japan. So I don't know where his head is at. You know, if it's about money, is it about not beating up his body and just sort of, I hate to say, coasting and taking it easy, which some say he's doing right now. Or does he just want to go home? You know, he came to a foreign country and he had success. He won the NXT championship. He won a Royal Rumble match. He wrestled for the WWE title at WrestleMania, even though he fell short. Now he's the United States champion. So you can talk all you want to about how disappointed you may be in the booking of Shinsuke Nakamura and how they've marginalized him, and this is not what I envisioned for him, but you cannot deny the fact that the guy has had more success than any other Japanese star I could think of that Vince McMahon ever hired to come in and work for him in the last 25 years, anyway. But, you know, maybe he's homesick. I'm sure he's got family back home and maybe he wants to go back to Japan. Maybe he's got friends and family there that he wants to just, you know, go back to. He wants to go back to his old life. I think he should do whatever makes him happy. If it were my decision to make for him, just based on the kind of matches I'd like to see him in, I'd like to see him back in New Japan, wrestling those guys. If Kenny Omega comes to WWE next year, then getting Nakamura back would not be such a bad trade-off for New Japan. Beth from Nashville, I recently read an article stating that AJ Styles, Shinsuke Nakamura, Luke Gallows, and Carl Anderson's contracts are coming due in January, with New Japan expanding into the U.S. and the joint show with Ring of Honor at Madison Square Garden in April. Do you think they all will re-sign with WWE, or will they jump ship? And if so, does the 90-day non-compete clause still come into play if the contract is up rather than them being released? Good question. My understanding is no. If their contracts lapse, if they run out, if they expire, the 90-day non-compete does not apply. They would be free the very next day to go work wherever they want to, TV, no TV. The 90-day thing only applies if they get, you know, cut or fired. If they get released, then it kicks in, and the company is obligated to pay them for 90 days. But if the contract just runs out, then they're free and clear to go wherever they want to go. And as far as, you know, what they're going to do I think they're leaving? I mean, I would think AJ stays. I mean, he's in a good position with the company, unless he's unhappy. He's in a great position. I see no reason for him to go anywhere. And so is Nakamura. He's not in a bad position himself, but like I just said, his home is in Japan. And so if he wants to go back home, or if he's not happy maybe with his role in WWE, then he'll leave. But I don't know where his head is at. Anderson and Gallows, same thing. I don't know where their head is at without asking them. But I think for sure they'd be more relevant, again, in wrestling if they left and went back to New Japan. But maybe they don't want to give that up. Maybe they're making a really good living for themselves, and maybe they just don't want to give that up. If I had to make a guess right now, I say that all four of them end up staying right where they are. Jay from the UK, I was wondering if you saw the recent Facebook post by Finn Balor, in which he states, "Regardless of the outcome, I just love being in the ring." This was after he lost to Baron Corbin on Monday. Legends like Bret Hart, Stone Cold, Steve Austin, Triple H, and Shawn Michaels are all notorious for protecting their character and have made it very clear that if you don't want to be the champion, you should not work here. While I still like Finn Balor, his post spoke volumes about his current position in the company. Do you think it is acceptable that Finn Balor has fallen out of the main event scene? I cannot blame WWE for his current lack of a push if Finn is not that interested in being the top guy. I don't think that's fair to say that he's not interested in being the top guy. We don't know that. Or you know, maybe it's the Daniel Bryan thing where he took that personality test once and scored in like the bottom 1 percentile when it came to ambition. You know, and they asked him, they said, "How have you been so successful for somebody who has no ambition? You know, who has no real drive?" And he said, "Well, I don't know. I just really like to wrestle." He was successful in spite of it. Maybe Finn is the same way. Maybe he just really likes to go out there and wrestle, and he doesn't sweat the small stuff. He doesn't pay attention. Look, when those rumors came out months ago that Vince McMahon was no fan of his, and he didn't think Balor was over enough, what did Balor do? The first thing he did on social media, right? Even in his promos, he started dropping little jokes about how I'm not over. And things like that. He turned it into a joke. He embraced it. He made fun of it. He mocked it. Now, maybe he did that because he knew it wasn't true. It was just some internet bullshit. But, you know, he just, that's what he does. He doesn't seem to take himself too seriously. He rolls with the punches. And he just really likes to go out there and wrestle. And if he had tweeted that wins and losses don't matter, that would have bothered me, because wins and losses are what WWE storylines are built around, right? Winning and losing determines who becomes the number one contender. Winning and losing determines who advances to the next round of a tournament, or who earns a spot in the Money in the Bank match, and so on and so forth. I didn't take what he wrote to mean that wins and losses don't matter. It's just that, you know, look, if I lost, but I love to wrestle, so I'm happy. I am getting sick, kind of sick, of Balor coming out there smiling every week, like a walking troll face. But I think he's just not factored into their plans right now. I don't think they're actively burying him. They're trying to get Baron... I said this before. They're trying to get Baron Corbin over with this Constable thing. They had a really good match on Monday, one of the only things I even liked about that show. And it's just not his time right now. It's more important that they try to get a new guy over at a top level. And I don't know if Corbin is going to end up being that guy or not. But they're going to try. They're investing in him. Now, once the feud with Corbin runs its course, if Balor is still out there losing matches every week, then I would be concerned. But right now, I'm really not that worried about the guy. Maybe a move to the SmackDown brand next year. If they do another superstar shakeup, maybe that's exactly what he needs. Maybe he needs to get the hell off Raw and get some new people to work with. Jad from London, England. My mailbag question concerns WrestleMania 34. A couple of days back, I rewatched the main event because I've been wondering if it is this WrestleMania that boasts the worst WrestleMania main event of all time. The reason I ponder this is because of the complete and utter disinterest and disdain shown by the crowd towards the match and the competitors. Beach Ball Mania ran wild once again and was greeted with boos when they were confiscated, as was Roman Reigns, plus chants of CM Punk, this is awful and boring, filled the arena, and the fans erupted when the match was over and Roman had not won. I know WrestleMania 9 could also compete for the title of worst main event ever, but in my opinion, WrestleMania 34 takes the cake. Does WrestleMania 34 have the worst WrestleMania main event of all time? And if not, which one does? It depends really on what you look for in a WrestleMania main event, I guess, right? It's a subjective thing. I look for not just a really good match. I look for something exciting. I want the crowd to be on their feet and really into it. I want it to feel like a big deal, like a special event. I just want it to feel like an epic battle. I feel like that's what the WrestleMania main event should be. And look, I get shit from people whenever I say that Roman Reigns has had some excellent matches in his career and has had some pretty damn good pay-per-view main events, because he has, and some people just don't like to hear that, or they like to give all the credit to his opponent, which is ridiculous. But I will say that the last three WrestleMania main events all sucked. And they all happened to involve Roman Reigns. Now, that doesn't include his first match with Brock Lesnar that he had at WrestleMania 31, which I thought was one of the better WrestleMania main events. I thought that was a great match. But Roman Reigns against Triple H at WrestleMania 32 sucked. And you could try to convince me otherwise. Maybe on another show? A non-WrestleMania show? Maybe I would not have looked at it as harshly. But for a WrestleMania main event, it sucked. Roman Reigns against The Undertaker at WrestleMania 33. Sucked. Now, he didn't really have a whole lot to work with in that match. And WrestleMania 34, Reigns against Lesnar, sucked. That's three in a row. And yes, the crowd response had something to do with that. The fact the match even happened in the first place, though, that was the problem. But I can't ever remember a WrestleMania main event where the crowd shit on it like it was freaking Backlash or Extreme Rules or some random B-show pay-per-view or like a television match. That should never, ever happen with your WrestleMania main event. And they should have known that going in. And they did, and they did not care. Now, let me take you back to 2014. If WWE had gotten their wish, our WrestleMania main event that year would have been Randy Orton defending the championship against Batista. Daniel Bryan would not have been part of that at all. What do you think would have happened in New Orleans if that was the WrestleMania main event? You would have had a reaction like you had this year at 34. Now, 30 ended up having one of the better WrestleMania main events in many, many years, that triple threat. And the story with Bryan and the big epic win, he taps out Batista, everybody goes crazy. Thank God they came to their senses and CM Punk walked out. And we got the match that made the most sense with the outcome that made the most sense. But that's not what the original plan was. Had they gotten their way, you would have had a carbon copy of what we saw this year. And imagine, we would have had, with the exception of 31 sort of sandwiched in there, you would have had almost, what, 5 straight years of shitty WrestleMania main events? Hell, I'll go back even further. I thought that Cena-Rock rematch at 29 sucked. So their track record with these WrestleMania main events over the last decade or so, it ain't good. Do I think the main event this year was the worst in WrestleMania history? No, I don't. That still belongs to The Miz against John Cena at WrestleMania 27. Miz would be way more believable in that position now, today. But back then, he had no business being in the WrestleMania main event. And the match, it was no good. For a television match, it was fine. For a WrestleMania main event, it was no good. There really were two big problems with that match. One, Miz should not have been in the WrestleMania main event. And two, it wasn't the match that they even really promoted for the show. Which is so weird, right? The championship match was John Cena against The Miz. You would never have known that if you really paid attention to the promotion for WrestleMania that year. The story was not Miz against Cena. It was Rock against Cena. Those two were cutting promos on each other every week, building to a match that wasn't even going to happen. That was the match that people wanted to see. Instead, Rock came out. He was the host of WrestleMania. And he comes out to restart the match after the double countout. And then he ends up laying out John Cena with a rock bottom, and he gives Miz the win. All that match was a plug. It was an advertisement for next year's WrestleMania. That's all it was. Victor from Donna, Texas. My question regards the buy or sell I posted in your Facebook group on which match you would rather see. Tomohiro Ishii versus Vader in Japan, or Andrade Cien Almas versus Eddie Guerrero in Mexico. You replied with Ishii versus Vader, and I just wanted to know what gives that match the edge for you over Almas and Eddie. I mean, look, Almas and Eddie would have been a fantastic match, but to me, those kinds of matches are sort of a dime a dozen these days. I mean, there's so many great matches from like a technical standpoint. I mean, just in this G1 that I've been watching, I can't keep up with all these match of the year candidates I've been watching from Ishii and Omega and Ibushi. I mean, it's insane. And I look at Ishii and Vader and I say, well, that's a battle between two big bulls that are just going to go in there and beat the holy hell out of each other. I can get behind that. We don't get to see too much of that where you have like, and look, Vader is what was back then anyway, a lot bigger than Ishii is now. Ishii's not like a big dude. But you get these two tough guys in the ring really hammering the shit out of each other. I just think it would be a lot more fun to watch. Technically speaking, it would not hold a candle to what Almas and Eddie could do. I don't doubt that as a match it would be better, but I just like it when you get two guys like that that go in there and beat the crap out of each other. So maybe it's like the whole car crash mentality, but yeah, I just think it would be more of a spectacle, I guess, to watch Ishii and Vader, which is why I would buy on that. Mason from Champaign, Illinois. I was hoping to hear your thoughts on Sting's Joker persona from TNA in 2011. I've been watching old clips of Impact and have been entertained as all hell by his character. Apparently, Joker Sting got a lot of hate from people online at the time, but a lot of people who post comments on the videos today seem to like it. And I know at the time you yourself said that you enjoyed it. What are your thoughts on it now, looking back? I did enjoy it. I still, you know, looking back on it now, I still enjoy it. I thought it was a different side of Sting that we had never seen before. I thought his talking, all the verbal stuff, was as good as anything I had seen from him in his entire career. I mean, I still laugh. I think back to one of those backstage segments they did. There was a camera that was... The camera back then on Impact, it was like this roving camera that would peep on people without them knowing. And so this camera is peeping on Sting in, I guess it would have been Hogan's office, and he's terrorizing Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan is sitting in his chair, leaning back, Sting's up in his face, standing over him, just acting all weird and cutting a promo on him. And Hogan has this look on his face like his jaw's agape. He's like terrified to even move. I don't know, just like little things like that that I still remember and I laugh about just thinking back on it. Sting went a little nutty during this period. Now, they probably stuck with it for too long and it got a little old, but overall I enjoyed it. I still wish he would have come, though, to WWE years before he did. So we could have gotten a slightly younger Sting, just a little bit, slightly younger Sting, wrestling with other top names that he didn't have the chance to wrestle. Undertaker, John Cena. I know he stuck with TNA longer than he should have. But Joker Sting was fun. I enjoyed it. Michael from Long Beach. Hope to see Michael at the meetup in a few weeks if he can make it. Legend has it that the late Dan Hartman's 1984 hit I Could Dream About You was originally meant for Hall & Oates, but they turned it down. Have you heard about this before? And do you think that song could work for Hall & Oates? Well, not only could it work for them, they've performed it since then. If you go on YouTube, you'll find them singing the song at their concerts. But yeah, that's not an urban legend. Daryl Hall has confirmed that story. He said Hartman wrote the song. And he came to them with it, thinking that they would be perfect to sing it. But I guess they had just finished an album, or their new album had just come out, and they just didn't really have a place for it. And so Hartman sang it himself, and it became a hit. Kurt from Phoenixville, Pennsylvania. I won't mention the note that he sent me, but I just wanted to say thank you to him here. I do appreciate it. Anyway, Kurt says, do you have any specific gimmicks or wrestlers that are almost unanimously considered underappreciated or unsuccessful by wrestling fans? An example would be Chris Kanyon's Mortis character in WCW, or Brian Kendrick's Spanky gimmick. As for underappreciated wrestlers, I've always loved Test and thought that he had the intensity, look, charisma, and size to be a legitimate main eventer if booked correctly. Also, no shame, I was entertained by Naked Midian. What underrated gimmicks or performers are you fond of, despite most fans disagreeing with you? When you say unanimously considered underappreciated, if I'm understanding what you're saying correctly here, honestly, the first name that came to mind for me is Waylon Mercy. I think a lot of people looking back now realize that that character had a lot of potential that was never realized. I mean, Spivey at that point, he was older. His body was thrashed. His back was just shot by that point. And actually, I think it was in a match with Diesel. There was a TV match on Superstars that he had with Diesel, and Diesel gave him a jackknife powerbomb. And I believe, as the story goes, it was on that powerbomb, just the way he... And it was, you know, it wasn't like Diesel dropped him the wrong way or anything like that. But the impact of him landing on that powerbomb, I think, ruined his back. And I don't think we saw him again. I'm not even sure he wrestled again after that for the company. So he was at the tail end of his career at that point and just physically could not hold up. And had he been able to, had he been healthy, I think he could have gone a lot further than he did. I'm not saying world champion, but that character was pretty freaky. I mean, you could see where Bray Wyatt borrowed from that character when he first debuted in the company. Well, I mean, in NXT. I guess is where the Bray Wyatt character would have debuted. But yeah, I think of Waylon Mercy. I mean, even his theme song, that, you know, the theme song, that evil stare he would give. He'd be really nice to everybody. He'd slap hands with fans on the way to the ring. He would shake his opponent's hand. He would shake the referee's hand. The referee would be like, what the fuck? He would shake the ref's hand. But then he would become a sadistic heel in the ring, and he would do heel things. And I just think he was very underrated. Now, Test, you mentioned him. I think Test should have gone a lot higher than he did, absolutely. He wasn't really anything to sing home about on the microphone. I mean, you said charisma. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, everybody has their own form of charisma. I never really thought of Test as being overly charismatic, to be honest with you. But he had talent. And, you know, he went out there not even a year after he debuted. He had that great match with Shane McMahon. And Shane McMahon was hardly an experienced worker. And so he went out there with Shane McMahon at SummerSlam in 99 and had what was my favorite match of that show. And what a great story, too, you know, that they had built around that match with Stephanie, and he's trying to win the love of Stephanie McMahon, and Shane is being the overprotective brother. I just love it. I love everything about that match. And then along came Triple H, and Test had his knees cut out from under him, and he never regained that same momentum after that. Naked Midian I could do without. Yeah, I could do without Naked Midian. But you know what stupid gimmick I enjoyed? He wasn't around very long, and it was dumb. But Just Joe. He was a shit stirrer. That was his gimmick. You know, he was the Woody Woodpecker of WWE. he would approach people backstage and he would say to them, oh, you know, so-and-so said something about it. Oh, did you hear about what so-and-so said? And they would be like, who are you? And he would just go, well, I'm just Joe. And he would walk off. It was so dumb, but I found him very entertaining, even if nobody else did. Tony from Buffalo, New York, what do you think about putting Alice Cooper in the WWE Hall of Fame? I'm a huge Cooper fan, as in addition to his music, he was also a part of both Friday the 13th and A Nightmare on Elm Street. He sang The Man Behind the Mask from Jason Lives, and he played Freddy's stepfather in Nightmare on Elm Street 6. It would also be a cool way for Jake the Snake to come back for the induction. Yeah, and you know what? He really enjoyed the experience, too. I've heard him in interviews talk about WrestleMania 3, and he was in awe of the whole thing and how nervous he was to go out there in front of the crowd, and, you know, how he gained a newfound respect, you know, when he was actually there and saw the show and everybody getting ready for it. So it's always cool to hear those stories about somebody from the outside coming in and gaining a newfound respect for what they do. And really, I mean, him putting the snake on Jimmy Hart, or trying to, it's one of those iconic WrestleMania moments. I think a lot of those moments from WrestleMania 3, just because of how epic that show felt in front of that crowd, probably are considered iconic. Piper putting Adrian Adonis to sleep at the end of their match. Obviously, Hogan Andre and Savage Steamboat. So, you know, Alice Cooper with the snake going after Jimmy Hart, another one of those iconic WrestleMania moments. And, you know, I think that really, I think anybody affiliated, frankly, with that WrestleMania 3 show could probably argue that, you know, they belong in the Hall of Fame just for being part of it. And he was one of the more memorable parts of it. So I wouldn't have any issue putting him in the celebrity wing. Absolutely. Tony also has a buy or sell on the better movie villain, Hans Gruber from Die Hard or Clarence Boddicker from RoboCop. Oof, that's a tough one. Hans Gruber is by far one of the greatest movie villains of all time, in one of the greatest action movies of all time. But I am going to buy on Clarence. I'm going to buy on Clarence. I'm going to sell on Hans Gruber. And I'll buy that for a dollar. I had to say it. I had to put that reference. How could I not? I had to put that reference in there. No, I mean, he was such an asshole in that movie. There wasn't one scene, I think, in that entire RoboCop movie that had Clarence Boddicker in it where he was likable in any way, shape, or form. At least in Die Hard, like, there's that one scene where, you know, Hans is with Bruce Willis. Bruce doesn't know that he's the big villain. He's masquerading kind of as a hostage. And he's pretending to be this guy, Bill Clay, and he's almost charming in that scene, right? Well, there ain't nothing charming in RoboCop about Clarence Boddicker. That death scene with Alex Murphy will haunt me until the day I die. That is still the most traumatizing movie death that I've ever seen. As ridiculous as it is to think that any human being can actually be shot that many times, with or without a vest, I don't care, and not be dead long before he was, it doesn't make it any less traumatic to watch that back. Even the Ed 209 scene in the boardroom where it malfunctions and he starts counting down, and the guy doesn't know where to go, and then he just shreds that guy. These are not things a six-year-old should see, by the way. But yeah, I have to buy on Boddicker. You'd be hard-pressed, I think, to find any less redeemable villain in a movie than he was in RoboCop. All right, so we'll end there. I think that's a nice mix of wrestling and non-wrestling stuff. Keep sending in those questions. We'll try to get to as many of them next week as I can. That'll be episode 559. Follow me on Twitter, at Solomonster. Please, if you have not already done so and you are thinking about attending our group meetup in Brooklyn, the day of NXT TakeOver, August 18th, the invite is up on Facebook. You can RSVP there if you're interested or if you know you're attending. And I will update that invite this week with more information on the menu and any drink specials. But everything is up there as far as address, as far as the prizes that are being raffled off by Julian. All that information is up there. Please RSVP. And also please join if you are able to do so. And if you are in town and want to go see some great wrestling, August 17th, Friday night, August 17th. 8 p.m. bell time, although there'll be, I think, some stuff happening in the hours before the show. That is the House of Glory show, High Intensity 7. I will be there. So if you are, say hello. Look forward to seeing everybody that weekend. Until next time, be well, stay safe, have yourselves a great week. I'm actually going to be traveling on business to Boston for the first time on Wednesday. All the places I've been, all the WrestleManias I've been to, and I've been out of the country, I've never been to Boston. I was thinking about that the other day. I said, wait a minute, I've been in Boston before. And no, I'm pretty sure I haven't been. So I'm only going to be there for the day. I don't really have time for anything else, unfortunately, but that'll be cool. I can sort of mark Boston off on my list. I don't know if I'll get to see Joe Numbers or anything like that, but we'll be in the same city at least. So that'll be on Wednesday, and I'll be back next Sunday with a brand new podcast. So until then, have yourselves a great week, and I will see you back here for 5:59 next Sunday. Until then, take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Salamonster sounds off.
They have Kane in the back. This is what he said. Tonight, I will delight as I enter the abyss with a fellow monster. But it is I who will climb out alone and with a smile across my face.
Oh, oh my God.
What do they think this is, Shakespeare?
I was driving yesterday, and some asshole double parks his car in the service lane.
I should have cut a promo the way the WWE would script one out for me. Why art thou parking like one's smelly orifice? I wish 1,000 deaths upon thee. Then I could do a fucking tope and we could fade to commercial.
Since 2007, The Salamonster Sounds Off. Available at thesalamonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solo Monsters Sound Off.